problem that we've got in this country is to identify good mentors. There are thousands of them running around and providing a service, but the problem is how good is that service? So during the last year, we've been working with an institution called the Institute of Business Advisors, who put their mentors through quite a rigorous process to qualify them. But in addition to that cooler, then also interviews them and make sure that they are of the caliber that we require. So when we go in, and most of the mentorship that we provide is post-funding, is to identify what the problems are in a particular business, and then to partner the SME with the mentor that can provide them with the skills, whether it be marketing, finance, or just general business. So that program is pretty well advanced as well.
And also, not only over to, but a big welcome to Mr. Pittler, the chair. It's always healthy, politically healthy, to see the top membership of an organisation present, but also you bringing everyone along. Is it Mrs. Normandy?
Yes, it's a woman.
Right.
It may not show, but...
Thank you. It's a chairperson. Are you going to address
yes,
us?
Yes, I will, thank you. Thank you very much, chairperson. And one must just say, Mr. Mlepo is our newly appointed CEO. I'm sure the committee is aware that Mr. Kola, went to the BEE community at the end of his contract last year. So we have Mr. Mlepo as our new CEO. Thank you. Just to say that in terms of the model, the original mandate is the one that prohibited, so to speak, a cooler from having a direct lending ability. At the time, the thinking was that if we utilize RFIs, we would be able to leverage on government business specifically, you know, as a carrot for banks to do the lending, with cooler giving the guarantees, you know, behind the loans going to SMEs. But over time, I mean, that has proved not to be successful. I'm not sure if I'm too close to the mic. That has proved not to be successful because what has tended to happen is that banks will only utilize the guarantees that Kula provides to the riskiest businesses because they don't want to take on the risk themselves. That has been the challenge of the model in the mean. We have entered into contracts with them, i.e. the banks, the big four. And we found that the most helpful, so to put it, has actually been APSA. You know, they have been more eager to take up and walk with us on the road of giving or accessing finance to SMEs. Now, it's very difficult to monitor generally if you are not the one that's doing the actual assessment, and that is why we feel that the direct lending model might probably be more useful. Because as I say, banks by nature are risk averse, and where there is to SMEs who don't have the knowledge and skills and experience or track record, you know, they tend not to want to finance them. So basically, I think it was an experimentation stage, and the government and ourselves from experiences could have realized that it hasn't worked as well as we would have wanted it to work. So that is why we're moving away from it. Now, in terms of privatizing things, I don't think the intention is to privatize. The intention is to take over, or rather to take equity in RFIs that are progressive and self-sustainable. So in other words, we are not going to be taking over banks, and the intention is certainly not to compete with the citizenry that are engaged in banking services, but rather to provide access to finance to people that are historically disadvantaged in particular, and people that ordinarily would not be given finance by your normal commercial banking institutions. We are working in conjunction with CEDA on the training and capacitation of the businesses that are startups especially. So in a sense, we are not engaged in the training ourselves. Where CEDA sees fit, they would, and I'm sure the CEO of CEDA is here, they would then refer to their own outsourcees for training that they otherwise do not provide. But certainly it is more to make sure that SMEs do access finance that they would otherwise not get from banks. That is the essence of our intervention. Thank you. I'm sure Mr. Mkhize might want to say something.
Yes, thank you very much, Mrs. Mapetla. And Mr. Mkhize.
Thank you.
I'm just not sure what your function is in Kula. Perhaps you could tell us.
My name is Mthembeni Mkhize. I'm the deputy chairperson of Kula. I wanted to respond to it, on a few issues, but the one that I'm going to start with is why not privatize Kula, or other comment was, why should the state be in competition with its own taxpayers in the form of the banks? The mandate, as it was stipulated, it stems from there is a sector which is SME and the lower end of the sector that the bank are not addressing. And so the banks, as they stand now, is an area that they don't have interest in. And therefore, no matter what could be done, they will not have interest. And in the past few years of Kula's existence, even with the collateral being put in place, the very same banks have not been really being highly active, except for one, or in the last past few years of Kula, probably just one financial year, there was a difference where one additional one was also showing interest. So I think Kula will carry on to improve access to finance for SMEs as the gap still exists. The problem with small medium enterprises is really the difficulties of accessing finance to be able to play a meaningful role in the very particular and very important sphere of our economy. The entrepreneurs, people that have got ambition to make things happen, but they don't necessarily come from very wealthy resources where they can be able to put collateral in place. So in other words, there's nothing stopping the taxpayers in the form of the banks to make sure that these entrepreneurs can access. And then the other one is the mandate and saying that where was it not really allowed for Kula. I think Ms. Mabetla explained that, but the mandate actually spelled it out that we were doing all our product, range of products, through the retail finance institutions and through banks. So there was no lending direct. It was through the banks or through the retail financial institutions. On the first question, the SMME support and the service providers, yes, the group of service providers, and since inception, Kula has been using the mentorship program, and we've got about in our database plus minus 400 of these SME mentorship service providers. And if you look at the slides that are showing the growth over the past 5 years, which is almost just over double in all the various sectors where there has been continuous improvement on making access to finance to be possible for these entrepreneurs, this program has been part of that, so we're not really embarking on it as a new strategy, but it's always been, and it's a continuation of that. And again, in the same level, again, asking for support in lending directly is actually the continuation of the strategy that says there's a need now to capitalize that. And much more details on the how and how it will be done, and again, we're not acquiring a bank. And the RFIs that we're talking about, again, those are RFIs that we are working with them, and that some of them we established as Kula, so it's much more getting much more engaged with the entities that or instruments that we've been using as a channel to lend to the SMEs. Thank you.
All right, thank you very much. We just need to move on with the other responses, please.
Maybe just to add to what Mr. Kizer said regarding the honourable member, Mr. The disbursements that we are talking about here are real money that has actually been given to the end users through our RFIs. And out of what we are talking about, you'll find that about 100 million is what has been issued through the indemnity credit, you know, as, you know, guarantee. And of course, those, as you would know, will only be called upon once there is an act of default. But the balance of the money, these are monies that have been dispersed to the beneficiaries by the RFIs.
Right, thank you very much. I'm just looking at the perhaps the question raised by the Honourable Ntuli. Are we responding to that? Was that responded to, do you think, Honourable Ntuli?
Yeah, I think I've been answered because I was asking whether that money is collateral or it's now got that to the it was cash to.
Right. Perhaps now we can also go back to the members of the committee. I will be taking fresh hands as a start, fresh ones to start off with. I can see two members just down there, hands up, and if you can just give me your faces, your names, please. The honourable member before that.
Kwabaza.
Honourable Kwabaza.
Yes.
Right. Yourself first, and then Honourable Njakalani, and then the Honourable Kotsi, in that order, please.
Thank you, Chairperson. The first question I'd like to ask on slide 11, you are indicating your performance indicators. I'd like to ask if you could give a geographical breakdown. In terms of provinces, on how you have been doing, just so that one has an idea of how geographically you have been spreading in terms of assistance to the SMEs. Secondly, I would like to ask if there is a relationship or collaboration between Kula and Umsobo Mufan. And lastly, Chairperson, on slide 19, you are indicating your projections for the next 4 years. I'd like to know just how much impact you have had in terms of creating jobs in the past 5 years up to now. And lastly, Chairperson, what mechanisms do you have to monitor the growth and sustainability of the SMEs that you are financing? Thank you.
Thank you very much. And then the Honourable Njekalana.
Ndiyabulela mhlala phambi. Ndibulise nakumaqabane DTR. Or let me greet my former colleagues of PTI, because we're in the new world now, the fourth parliament. The bully is no man too. I hope she won't miss us. Chair, I think the first thing we need to say is to give credence, shall I say, or praise to, I can confidently say, Comrade Kola Stoller now. Now that is, there's no barriers between me and him as a comrade. History needs to be articulated in its correct sense, because Kola Stole was one of the greatest champions for Kula Direct, which was supported by this committee in the past term. And then Ntate Mlapo, ke tsepa gore wa itse ke ne go ditlhako tse kgolo tse kgolo go feta. I was just saying that Mr. Mlapo has got into big shoes which were created by Father's thought. Now, the question, the mandate, the first one that strikes me is that the Kula claims that it's the sole development finance institution charged with a mandate exclusively focused on SMEs. Now, a couple of things come in there. We may not articulate that in full, but I look at your MAFISAs or rural economy and ask myself, does that mean that you will go into that area and how would you work with your MAFISAs or the Landberg? I would assume sometimes even grown farmers would need 100,000, 70,000 and that sort of thing. Would you be linking up with that area? Also, around achievements, in your slide 9, you make reference to a network or a footprint of 290 branches. It would be of interest to just to look at the character. What do you mean by 290 branches? Is that link with the RFI? Or is it actually the RFIs themselves? And just as a comment, I hope in this new term we will start, you know, reconditioning ourselves and speak in the context of a developmental state, you know. Unless I tend to pander into wrong terms, Chair, because I have a little bit of a chill down my spine if you talk about profits in Kula. This is a government institution. It would be better we talk about surplus. We're not making profits in Kula. And we're not making profits in Kula. Not for now, but it would have been helpful in terms of the development cap target. Over and above what Honorable Gwabaza has said, had requested, that we also compare those categories with the performance in the past financial year, that is 2008-09. Maybe it's too early to have it now, but down the line it would be helpful. How many new loans were given, and the loan book, and so forth. I'll just rush, Chair. I think down the line as well, the database and profile of RFI could be quite helpful. You know, I think what one would do is to maybe just list the other questions, share them with the other members, and submit them to Kula, because I still have quite a lot. But the last just few points is that, given that Kula Direct now is a reality after a long-drawn struggle, my expectation was that its introduction might also trigger the necessity of some legislative changes. But it seems that the presentation is silent of that, just as a matter of interest. And also, I trust and hope in terms of our planning as the trade and industry down the line would have a briefing on Kula Direct a little bit more in detail, Dr. Matuna, through you, Chair. We just fought hard to get Kula Direct as a concept in the past. Now it is a reality. We need to get to know a little bit more detail about it so that down the line when we exercise oversight over it, we would have had a deeper sense of what it is all about. Thanks for now.
Thank you very much, Honorable Njekalana. And then we had just after that, and we will take Honorable Ntuli just now, but Honorable Kotsi.
Thank you, Chairperson. Chair, perhaps as a new member in this committee, I would be interested to know what RFI. The second question would be, the presenter spoke about that Kula will be, there's going to be recapitalization of Kula in terms of the retail. My question then would be, the presenter know by now, by how much would that be in terms of that recapitalization? I'm interested to know the Kula, what is their target in terms of their core business? What is their target and what is their accessibility rate in terms of people accessing that and success rate as well? The last question is, I know that even people in the urban areas find it difficult to get loans and other assistance from Kula in the urban areas. My question is then, if they are spread through rural areas, how do they manage to do that? What is their success rate? And I'm sure perhaps there are no structures in the rural areas. How does that assistance come to those people who are far from everything? Thank you.
Thank you very much. Honorable Ntuli.
Yeah, thanks, Chairperson. I'm talking from experience. When you go to the township and rural areas, where you find people saying that, particularly in KwaZulu-Natal, where you find that Itala was giving that task to lend money, and people always complain that it's not accessible. I want to find out from you. I mean, the banks in their nation, they are there to make profit. I mean, I want to find out from you the challenges you are facing, I mean, to persuade the banks to lend these monies, because we may sit here and say we are doing this and you are doing this and that, but when you go down there, it is the same as the other questions which has been asked by the members here. In real terms, when you go down there, then you find that it's so difficult to access, and people will come to us and you say, no, Kula will assist. I just want to find out from you, what are the real challenges? As I said, that the banks are there to make profit, and you are using banks to lend money to the people, and you find that they are reluctant to do so. Thanks.
Honourable Maria, follow up, I'll take it.
Thank you, Chair. Now, just follow up, but just additions to what has been asked already. The one is on the targeted provinces. You can also give us indication of how you came to those three provinces being targeted and how the division is between the three. Then secondly, there's an example on slide 19. It is an example when an investment of 3 billion rand, what that will produce. Can you give us an indication of the jobs that will be created, say in the next 4 years, and how you intend to monitor and report on that? And then maybe the very most important one for me, a question. It seems like Kula, and especially Kula Direct, has become very similar like banks. For instance, Land Bank, where governments shareholder, and it seems like the more it's becoming the territory of Treasury. We have been given basically no quantitative explanations today in terms of volumes of business, in terms of budgets, in terms of what you intend to get as a return on investment, how much is available, how much have you requested for, you know, what is the cost of Kula Direct, especially with the acquisitions that you intend to do. We know that the economy has gone down. We know that the revenue for government has gone down drastically. Is that going to affect Kula and Kula Direct? And you know, can you maybe give us more quantitative information with regards to all these challenges? Thank you.
Yes, I do just have one or two areas I would like to pursue, and that is, I think we're all aware, we're in a development state. We have a developmental state. I noticed that Kula has referred to a development approach, etc. Would be helpful to me if you could just indicate to the committee your understanding of Kula's role in a developmental state and not simply pursuing development. The second area, which would be quite useful, is in this area of talking about additional coverage and that kind of thing. As you are aware, and I noticed that myself with slide 19, you are pursuing employment creation, in fact, as a rather primary objective through access to finance and so on and so forth. And I thought that that was very welcome in view of the fact that it is not necessarily through monetary policy, but through the micro, that is, trade and industry, etc., that we will be able, in fact, to achieve more employment and create more job opportunities. But if you could just indicate very clearly, on the one hand, you talk about broad challenges and enhancing service delivery and a new model. You know, it would be helpful if you could get to the essence of that. It's not going to help this committee if we go back to Parliament and to the people of our country and simply say, Kula's now got this new, you know, platform, etc., in order to enhance service delivery. What does that mean? Thank you. I'd also just like to welcome and thank members from the Department of Finance as well as Economic Development of the Ministry as well, observing. Thank you.
Thank you, Chairperson. I think, you know, without really one going question by question, we'll try and answer as many of these as possible in an, you know, almost encompassing many of the aspects that have actually been asked, and where I fall short, my colleagues will come in to help. The issue of the geographical spread in our business plan, we believe that, you know, the three provinces, which is Gauteng, Western Cape, and KwaZulu-Natal, are the most economically developed, and the rest are normally excluded from that in terms of, you know, what we look at as designated provinces. And therefore, the numbers that we are talking about here would be to those provinces that exclude these three, because we believe that people staying in Gauteng, Western Cape, and KZN, and they would, you know, have access because of the economic activities around those areas. And we normally, therefore, lump the other six provinces together to say that we need to ensure that whatever business that we do, we have to spread our reach to those provinces that are outside of this, you know, triangular, you know, diamond, as it is referred to. And the relationship with Umsobomvu, we believe that, you know, we are not really operating in an island, and where things require of us to refer entrepreneurs to Umsobomvu, the same way as people may come our way wanting facilitation of change of ownership, we need to point them to the right, you know, organization. And this is what, you know, is being done to make sure that when it comes to the transactions that fit within the Umsobomvu mandate, that we actually refer them, you know, to Umsobomvu. I just wanted to maybe come to the issue of the 290 branches. This is measured through the retail financial, you know, intermediaries that we are using. These intermediaries have got branches all over the country, and including CEDA. And we believe that this is the reach that we can actually have in ensuring that we have got as much reach as possible. And what is good is that when we look at them, they actually are present, you know, in almost all the provinces. And that is what we are talking about when we talk of the 290 branches. Kula has got branches in the 9 provinces, CEDA as well, but also including the retail finance, you know, financial intermediaries as well. I think thank you very much for the referral to the issue of profit. I think indeed we need to start talking about surplus so that we, you know, we can actually be relevant. And then the retail financial intermediaries, maybe just to answer your question, ma'am, these are the non-traditional, you know, commercial banks. These are people that have been established with niche markets to go out there and reach, you know, some of the SMEs. And what we have done as Kula is to partner with them so that, you know, we can then through them make sure that we have got as much impact as possible. So this would in other words exclude your normal commercial banks. They would also exclude your business partners. And these are purely organizations that are set up with a specific niche, a specific market to actually, you know, make sure that they reach the SMEs. And what we have done is utilize them, leverage on their footprint to make sure that we can reach as many entrepreneurs as possible, because we found a lot of them having reached into some of the most remote, you know, areas of our country. And I think maybe this is exactly why we talk of Kula Direct. We are saying that there is a limit to the level where we believe the commercial banks can actually do. Commercial banks, by their nature, are risk averse. And they would therefore not look at people who do not have a salary slip, as an example, who do not have a collateral. But what is it that we envisage doing as Kula is to ensure that we get closer to the cash flows, understand how a business without a contract, an entrepreneur without a contract, with a market that is available, we can analyze that business to understand that they can actually still be supported. When you go to commercial banks, they normally want an element of history in order for them to help you, or some element of collateral. And we believe that that specific market, sector of the market, is actually underserved. And this is where we believe that as we have, you know, established processes, we now have got a clear understanding of that particular sector of the market. It is going to be, you know, easier for us to actually service that. And I think that is exactly why Kula Direct, to make sure that that part of the market that everybody else is shying away from, with the history that we have, the experience that we have developed over a number of years, that we can specifically go in and make sure that we provide funding to those people. Because, you know, study has shown that your 250 and lower are still the majority of underserved, you know, markets in this country. Maybe let me leave to my other colleagues to take some of the questions. Thank you.
Can I just appeal to Kula, just to be succinct? I would also like to invite the Deputy Minister to comment. Obviously not necessarily now, but when she would wish.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. As a new Deputy Minister, I've been sitting on that side of the bench, it's now on this side. I've been the one that has been asking like those, but now I'm this side. But what I like to say is that, talking about Kula, We all have been lamenting that Kula is not really doing what it was supposed to be doing. We have been lamenting that people are still paying high interest rates that are charged by the commercial banks. Now, I think Kula Direct is starting to answer that particular aspect, that challenge that we have been faced with. We were saying why Kula is a wholesale. Now, we are starting to answer that particular question. Looking at what was happening, and looking at the issue of collateral that the director has been talking about here. Now, Kula Direct is going to answer the issue of financing the real small business people right down in the rural areas. And with Kula Direct and other intermediaries who are trying to coordinate the issue of financing small business, we're trying to work together with the provinces. We're trying to work together with other agencies that are in the DTI. For instance, CEDA, looking at the issue of training, looking at the issue of mentorship. Now, if we develop a particular industry, we will be working as a collective, not as separate entities. We'll be working as a collective. Somebody will be looking at training those people. Somebody will be looking at mentoring those people. Somebody will be looking at financing those people and monitoring what is happening, not only by us here nationally, but together with the provinces and local government in particular. So I think Kula Direct is starting to answer those questions, starting to say let there be coordination, starting to say let all the financial financial intermediaries come together and know what each other is doing. Because as it is at present, people can just go anywhere and I call it a school of hard knocks and learn from the University of Hard Knocks. You go there, you knock hard, you come back. You go to the other side, you knock hard, you come back. Now we're trying to say, no. Here's a hope that can spread into all the provinces. Secondly, what I would like to highlight is that we would love to see a situation where we work with a province. Because our provinces are unique, they are not the same. I think all of us will agree on that one. Mpumalanga is not like like KZN. And KZN is not like Eastern Cape. Now, if we know what is happening in KZN, we know what is happening in Mpumalanga, we know what is happening in the Eastern Cape, it will be much easier for Kula to work with the intermediaries that are in KZN and those that are in Mpumalanga, in all the provinces. Because our provinces are unique. You cannot have a blanket way of working with the provinces. Hence the issue of the prioritized provinces that we are talking about. And together, we can make it happen. We can make it work better. If we all sit down and look at what is happening in the provinces, how can Kula then assist those provinces with these intermediaries that we are talking about? I think in short, Chairperson, I just wanted to raise this issue of coordination, this issue of other institutions working together with Kula, and Kula taking its role as a developmental bank, not necessarily a bank that is supposed to make profits as somebody has said it properly, that we don't make profits, we're talking about surplus. I'll stop there for now, Chairperson.
Thank you very much, Deputy Minister. I think you've clarified several important points for us, and maybe that's because you sat on the other side in the previous Parliament. I have a far clearer understanding as to what Parliament is interested in. However, there may have been just two outstanding points, and I really would like to appeal to Kula. I know time is not on our side, and I do apologise for that, but can you please conclude that succinctly? Thank you very much, Mr. Mkhize. I think I see you ready.
Thank you, Developmental States, Concept of Developmental States. The slide number 7, it highlights that. It talks about jobs as, well, it actually calls the triple bottom line in that pyramid. Pyramid on the left talks about jobs, rural development, women PE. So in that sector, actually, you target certain areas because that's developmental nature. While you're still focusing on access into finance, but you go a little bit deeper than just giving money to achieve certain goals and ensuring that both jobs are being created. Again, we also moving on in the peri-urban areas, which is our urban areas that are just as poor as the rural because of certain challenges that they face. On that one, we look at the migration from just getting a job to getting decent jobs by certain interventions. The how part in that is basically, it forms part of the prioritization of the sectors that we target, that we know they will deal with those issues of creation of decent jobs, which applies much more into peri-urban areas as opposed to rural. And then obviously women and the BE as well. I'm going to quickly move into the enhancing and the broad services that you talk about on Kula Direct. In one slide, we talk about that the Kula Direct will be much more in detail. That covers quite a few questions that are asking about where is the detail as far as the Kula Direct, because it has been approved. The amount of work that needs to take place in creating, one, the business plan of Kula Direct and also the implementation plan has already started with a strategy document leading into that. But we will come and present that it should be the work that you mentioned in one of the slides, that it should be the work that is done between us and Kula. I think basically that's the last one is the amount, when a member asked about the amount of man capitalization, he said it is at the moment without the detailed business plan, we said 3 billion rand, but that will be broken down as we go forward, but we're talking about it over the period on that. That's the amount. And also to say what is RFI, this is a retail finance institutions. Those are like of not necessarily banks, but institutions that have focused in the areas of SME financing, and they then come to us and we work through them as one of our channels of accessing the SMEs. I think that's about it. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Certainly we would like to thank the leadership as well as all of the workers at Kula for being here and indicating through their presence here this morning that they would like to ensure that Parliament does get an accurate understanding of your role in creating decent work and eradicating poverty through a DFI approach. So thank you very much. Clearly we will need to interface with Kula again. We can't at this stage indicate exactly when that should be. But really must apologize for cutting people short who have so much more to offer. But time is against us. And we need to move on to the IDC and to make space for that input. I know that the Minister, Tundi Tobias, was going to be here just at any point, and I'm not sure if she walked in while I was looking down. Is she here yet? Not yet. Right. So the advantage point of mine is not that good. I should have had a high chair, but just to get a better look at everyone. Thank you very much. So We are going to, just so that members don't get concerned about the schedule, we did need to hear more about Kula. I'm sure you appreciate that. But we are moving on to the IDC at 10:30 or just beyond 10:30. We will continue with that until about 12:15. So I would like that both IDC as well as ourselves as members of the committee are able to be far more succinct in our engagement with them. So we just getting the members of IDC before us now. Thank you. Right. I am familiar with some of the folks here in the IDC through other structures. I see there's the CEO here, Mr. Jeffrey Quenner. You're very welcome. I also see Muslim Lumkili Mondi and Mr. Neo Sawazi. You could just hold up your hands when I say that. It's Miss. Unfortunately, I saw some program once, and the person was called Neo, and he's a young man. Yes, I think it is very gender neutral, some of the names, yes. Then Mr. Christo Vanzel. Right, so we've got you all here, but obviously it's going to be over to Mr. Jeffrey Quenner, the CEO, and just to get an understanding from the Deputy Minister at this particular point, I know that there's a division of work and mandates at DTI, not just too sure under who this falls on the operational side in terms of the political leadership.
Chairperson, it falls under the Minister and the First Deputy Minister. I do the second economy, but part of their job falls under my jurisdiction as well.
Of course, I wouldn't have spoken about a first or second, but simply two deputies. And I think the second economy is, of course, the first priority. But over to yourself then, Mr. McQuenna, the Chief. I'll just be sitting down here. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Chair, and the members of the committee, also to our Deputy Minister and the DG, for truly affording us this opportunity to come and share with the committee what we do and what we plan to do and how we see our intervention and how we really respond to the government's priorities. I'd like to hasten to apologize on behalf of our chairman, chairperson, who is out of the country, and she had sent her apologies. He would have loved to join us. For an institution that has been established since 1940, Chair, I think it could be said that IDC has indeed done relatively well, but we as an institution do realize that there's still a lot to be done. If one looks at our vision, which is to be the driving force for industrial development and innovation, I think this is still relevant as it was towards then. In terms of the objectives that we as an institution want to look at is really supporting industrial capacity and promoting entrepreneurship. And all of those activities that we do as an institution, we always aim that the outcomes that I've listed there, some of them being, in fact, the key one being sustainable employment, regional equity, sectorial diversity, ensuring that new entrepreneurs enter the economy and the broad-based black economic empowerment. Those are the outcomes we hope through our different interventions, be it
small deals, the large projects that we do. So we're hoping that we will be able to achieve that. Thanks.
Have I got a different presentation?
My apologies, Chair. I should have said the first part of the presentation is the economic overview, which we are putting for the members for information. But I know the DG in the DTI presentation will be covering some aspects of that, and hence to avoid duplication and also being mindful of the time, we're not going to touch that. Thanks for making me raise it. In terms of the role that we see, we're supporting sustainable development, being the creation of jobs, regional representation, black economic empowerment. But also in our role, we see that we look at the future sustainability of the project rather than the historical. The historical gives us a sense, but it's really the future. And hence, where other financial institutions see businesses as a high risk, we see those as an opportunity and a market failure, and we see how we intervene. Also, we see IDC's role as a catalyst in project development. You'd see if you look at IDC's activities, there's a number of big projects that we do where this is evidenced. And we also cover a number of sectors. I've got two slides which I will go through that, which gives a wide range of the sectors to ensure that our intervention is indeed representative. The next two slides, as I said, they give the committee members a sense of where we are. The first line on portfolio that gives you, including the commitments would be those where we've approved the facilities, if it's loans, if it's equity, or if it's guarantees, but they have not been drawn. But then the bulk of that is the money that has been dispersed. The approvals shows the values that we, for the financial period ending March 2009, because our period is April to March, that shows in the different sectors what we have approved. Not necessarily all of that would have been drawn, but some of it would have been drawn because there's a time lag always. And then the jobs for the different sectors show the jobs that we expect to be created and saved in some instances for that period, for those approvals which I've referred to above. Because what we do, as I said, one of the key outcomes that we look at is to see at sectors that have an ability to create jobs, and then what we do is we measure those jobs, and when during the approval stage with the interaction of the entrepreneurs or aspiring entrepreneurs, we inquire the extent of the job that will be created, but also we do our own tests from the experience that we've had that indeed those jobs are possible to be created. So that gives you a sense, as the committee members would see, some sectors don't necessarily create as many jobs as others, but it's one of the things that you look at. You'll see construction, for an example, for an approval of 760 in the previous financial year. We're expecting to create about 4,500 jobs. If you go to the next slide, if you look at the PPP, although we're putting in about 2.6 billion, but the jobs there are about 2,000. So it's the nature of the sectors that we invest in. Some of them are more labor intensive than others. But these are the direct jobs. I mean, there's the indirect jobs which we don't necessarily count, which one, if one uses the multiplier effect, others use the 3 or others use the 5. I mean, then the impact is much, much more than what you see here. In terms of just a review of the period, our financial information has been finalized, the audit has been finalized, and it will be approved by the board at the end of the month. But in terms of what we've done, as I said, we're expecting in total about 24,300 jobs will be created. It is indeed a decline from the previous year, but I think it also reflects the economic situation that we find ourselves in. However, if we look at the number of jobs we're expecting to save, that is an increase. We're looking at about 2,500 compared to the previous period. In terms of the value, I think we've seen that it is indeed also an increase, which is a signal that IDC demand for funding is indeed is there. So for SMEs, small and medium-sized enterprises, we've seen an increase because IDC, as I would demonstrate in the later slides, we participate for the on the SME side, but also on the large projects. In terms of the during that period, we also approved a number of schemes because we do from time to time try and see where the bottlenecks are or where the real intervention is needed, and then we come up with some schemes which can really enable to one way unblock or also maybe in some instances try and fast track certain objectives that we have set. Some of the schemes that I'm referring to here is the clothing and textiles and footwear scheme, where the board approved that we set aside 250 million rents at a very low interest rates of prime less 5 to help that sector to modernize. That is the real intention, which scheme was approved in September last year. We also have a scheme on the gold loan fund, where we've seen that the small and medium-sized enterprises have been battling to really access that, so we've made some facility available. Also on the forestry and the orchard one, there we've seen that because of the long-term nature of those industries, it is indeed for us necessary that we bring in a facility where we put in some long-term financing, but at very favorable interest rates. I mean, for the pro-forestry, we put in 100 million rands, and for the new or pro-orchard schemes, we've put in 200 million rands to encourage not only BEE, but to encourage the growing of more orchards and forests. In terms of how our funding has been applied for the year ending 2008-2009, and the pie chart at the bottom, we're demonstrating that a number, about 36% of that is startups, early stages, which to us at least demonstrate that we do indeed take more risks than what you'd find in other institutions where they would be looking at balancing their portfolio. So we're wanting to see that new capacities being developed and new ideas come to the fore. We've also seen that there's a 5% on restructuring and rescues. That refers to when some of the companies experience some difficulties, we have a unit that looks at them and tries and brings back some life and finds way of assisting them. We also participate outside of the rest of the continent, and in that in this financial year, about 25% of those investments would be in outside of South Africa. In terms of our medium-term objectives, starting with the financial year period that we're in, we're aiming to invest about 11.4 billion, which is an increase from the previous performance. Within that 11.4 billion, we in terms of our plans, about 3 billion has been earmarked for companies that are experiencing some distress as a result of the downturn we find ourselves in. I will talk a little bit about more about what it is that we do exactly for those companies, and we expecting that about 26,000 jobs will be created from this investment. And of that 11.4, about 1.5 would be in the rest of the African continent. The table there just gives a sense of at least our expectation of where this investment would be. This is in terms of the plans, obviously. I think as things crystallize, it might change. This 11.4 is indeed to us at least a sign that we are stretching this IDC balance sheet to try and grow so that the impact that we have is even more significant than ever before. If we look for the next 4 years, 2010 to 2012, year ends, we in terms of the plans that we are planning, that at least 40 billion has been budgeted to be invested over that period, so of which about 7 billion of that would be to the rest of the continent, and if things go according to plan, I think a significant number of jobs would be created as a result of that intervention. I've sketched to the committee what we're planning to do, and but how is IDC funded. I think I'm piggybacking from the question I was listening, which was raised in the Kula presentation. What I did not say in the introduction, Chair, is we cooperate with a number of institutions. In fact, the CEO of Kula was an IDC employee, so we've one of our stars. So we've gladly helped the fellow member institution. In fact, even Ola himself, who was praised by the members, was also an IDC. So over and above the funding, we helped strengthen the other DFI. In terms of our financial base, because if you look at our assets, committee members, it's made of the investments that we've made. Some of them are historical, some of them are new, but also there's loans. And in terms of our reporting, we have to value our investments on a mark-to-market basis in what is called fair value adjustments. So a number of our investments are also listed in the Securities Exchange. And so when the values decline, then we've also seen that value of our investments having declined. So there's been a significant decline, mark-to-market of our values. But having said that, we would like to believe that the balance sheet is still strong enough to be able us to do a bit more to really strengthen our involvement. And if you look at the plans that I've mentioned to the committee members of investing about 40 billion in the next 4 years, if we include this year, it will be 51. We would see then we have to go out and borrow, our borrowings increase them from about 5.9 to about 25 billion, just shy of 25 billion. Because how we fund ourselves is from the investments that we've made, the growth, the dividends, and the interest that we receive from those loans that we've given out. But also we go out and we borrow into the market, so we don't get any funding from our shareholder, at least. Not since 35 odd years ago. But we see this balance sheet that we have saving as a good buffer so that we can be able to do these greenfield projects, so that we can do these large projects. So I think it really comes in good stead, even with the decline that we've experienced. In terms of how we've aligned our activities with the national objectives, in terms of unemployment, as I said, it's one of our key outcomes that we've looked at. So we continuously look at labor-intensive industries such as agriculture. I think there's a number of opportunities that we've seen, and we have indeed helped start a number of those projects. In terms of entrepreneurial and small and medium-sized enterprise development, we've adopted a multi-faceted approach where we've looked at the funding, because we know funding is not only the solution, particularly for new entrepreneurs. We're looking at the training as well. And the business support. So some of it we will do internally, some of it we will have service providers, which then they would interact with those new entrepreneurs that we're funding. So through that, and then we can be able to finance it. But we're also in partnership with other development finance institutions, Kula, but also in partnership with the Land Bank as well. We've also helped during the time that they were in trouble, seconded some of the people, but we also co-invest in some of the investments. We also collaborate with the Development Bank of South Africa. In terms of rural and regional development, we do understand that, and we do appreciate that something needs to be done, because there's a skewness in terms of the provinces that benefit most. I mean, if we look at the investments that we've made in the previous financial year, still the bulk of that still goes to the three provinces, Gauteng, KwaZulu-Natal, and the Western Cape, but there's a concerted effort really for us to try and skew and to change that picture. And then how we do that, one of the interventions we've done is to help establish development agencies. Those agencies work with the local municipalities to help identify projects, and then they would come to the IDC for funding, not only IDC, but they also go to other institutions. But we help build that capacity so that they can unlock some of those investments. And we've seen some of the investments which IDC has also funded, where people who were not farmers previously, but as a result of the intervention of the development agency, now we're able to farm and they're exporting some of their products overseas as well. But also what we did was, because we wanted to ensure that we extend our reach, we opened all the regional offices. I mean, last year, in fact, before last year, IBC had only four offices in South Africa, and we're covering all the provinces just to make sure that our footprint is there. But also when we look at our projects, I think we pay a specific emphasis on ensuring that those projects do indeed take advantage of what works in those provinces. We'll see that largely in agriculture and forestry, mining and tourism, to ensure that we give a good spread. The South African map on the right just shows the status of the different development agencies. The red ones, those are that have been approved previously. The green ones are the ones that have been approved in the previous financial year. And then the blue ones are the ones that we're looking at establishing. So far there's been great successes and obviously varying in different of these development agencies. In terms of broad-based black economic empowerment, we also, is one of the outcomes from our activities. Our emphasis now is on what we refer to as expansionary BEE. What we mean by that is that when we fund companies which introduce black economic empowerment, we want to see a significant portion of those, of our funds, going to expand the capacity of that entity, as opposed to just changing shareholding. We'll still do that, but we would like to see more of that going into expanding that entity so that jobs can be created as well. But also what we've done to encourage women development, we established a fund which we call Transformation and Entrepreneurial Scheme, which is a 1 billion Rand fund to try and bring in new entrepreneurs, and 40% of that has been earmarked for enterprises which are run, owned, and or controlled by women. But also we've looked at putting something for disabilities and the communities, because we do find some of the projects, in fact, that we fund have communities don't necessarily benefit, so we're finding a mechanism of really having the communities take a stake into those, and also the development fund looking at how they can bring in their workers as well into ownership. We also have a number of projects which we're looking at renewable and cleaner technologies, because we do understand whilst we're still having some challenges as far as power generation is concerned, we cannot lose sight to the fact that we need to start looking at bringing in new and cleaner technologies. So there's a number of there's an effort in looking at a number of these. We're also looking at a study, hopefully, which will help direct us in terms of how can we be efficient as South Africans as far as energy is concerned. We it's not only the funding that we look at, but we also participate either through the Department of Trade and Industry or other departments in terms of assisting, be it through research or input into the development of the policies, and that is why we participated in the development of the Industrial Policy Action Plan and the National Industrial Policy Framework. But we also did some technical analysis to support government on the policy measures so that we can help see what is the impact of those policies that are being designed. We also participate in the DFI Council, which is the council is looking at how best the DFIs can really cooperate amongst themselves, and we're spending a bit more time as well on really seeing what role can we play as far as power generation is concerned. In terms of assisting companies in distress, as I said, for this financial year that we're in, we've earmarked about 3 billion, and in the following year we're hoping that we'll also earmark about 3 billion. Our approach really is to assist these companies so that the long term they're sustainable, so we understand that they will be going through this distressed situation because of the cyclical factors, and hence we look at it on a firm by firm basis. And our interventions is really to ensure that the companies benefit. So we try not by putting in our fund facilities that we take out the existing shareholders, but to see how we can work with them together. So our approach is really on risk sharing. So when there are other commercial funders, even in there, we try and encourage them to stay. In terms of our participation, as I said, we do SMEs, but we also do large projects. I mean, this slide, Chair, is trying to demonstrate that there's a number of these big projects that we're looking at, the projects that will have a huge impact into the economy of our country. And as I said in the earlier slide, we see ourselves as IDC as a catalyst in terms of project development. So this is just giving a sense of the different types. I mean, the amounts there show the size of the projects, not necessarily the extent of IDC participation, but we are looking at those. These are long-term. Some of them will only take about 3 or 4 years to come into fruition, but we have to start now to be able to really develop them, because we're saying whilst we assist companies that are in distress, at the same time let's help build capacity and our participation in these projects as an evidence. The last slide, Chair, is really just a way in which we said when we listened to the State of the Nation address by the President of the country, we grouped the call it the themes from in the State of the address. We're saying there is a role for the IDC to play in a number of these, and most of them I've covered in there. But I think be it in government planning, we have a role in terms of either giving input in the policy development, be it in supporting companies in distress, be it supporting SME and BEE, be it in terms of on the creation of the jobs. So as IDC, we'd like to believe that we're geared and we are able to assist government in the development. This is a brief chair overview, and I would like to, through your permission, invite the committee that we can have even a much more detailed presentation of what we do, because there's a number of areas that we get involved in. And thanks, Chair.
Yes, we'd like to thank you too, Mr. Geoffrey Quenner. I would also like to take this opportunity of welcoming the Deputy Minister, Thandi Tobias Bakolo. Just don't see her as I'm sitting down, but I do know she's here, and you are very welcome. Thank you for joining us. Thank you. Members of the committee, we're looking at 11 o'clock. I must thank you for your very succinct, concise, and speedy presentation. I'd like to take some questions. I see the Honourable Turok, the Honourable Marais. Another person, please. 3 questions, perhaps. Yes, the Honourable Kutsi. Right, can we move on there in that sequence, Honourable Turok?
Thanks very much, and thank you for an excellent document and an excellent presentation, as always. I actually ticked all the boxes, and I think you have done that, all the boxes that you were meant to address. I also appreciate very much that you have a response to the State of the Nation address at the end. Maybe all the partners should put them at the beginning so that we identify where the country is going. It's not really meant to be an afterthought. It's meant to be a direction for the country, and I think everybody should respond to it. I also want to say that I appreciate very much the large project that you've listed on on your slide 27. I really think that the IDC ought to give priority to those projects. We need to grow our economy as a whole, and the large projects do have enormous downstream effects, and I think that the country has possibly neglected that over the last decades. So for me, the large projects listed are really fundamental to growing the economy and not an addition to the whole program. Maybe that's a personal view, but I'm sure that our committee would feel the same way. I also appreciate, and by the way, my comments are going to deal a little with the economic data together with the policy issues. I think I can't separate them. And maybe there may be maybe there's something I say that the DG would like to reply to, and maybe you could leave that for him to respond to, but it's difficult to separate the policy from the data and the implications. So if you don't mind, I'll deal with them in that way. The South-South question, very important for us. I'm surprised that South Africa was not at the meeting in Russia taking place, reported this morning, the BRICS meeting. And I wonder if that isn't undiplomatic to ask, were we invited? If not, what is the situation? It is a terribly important meeting, and the issues raised and reported in today's papers are very critical for our future and for the South-South question. So perhaps, Mr. Kena, you or the DG could respond to that. I know that we have been working in association with Brazil and India, so and Russia in a way, and so it seems to me this is something that we need to look at. I also find your comments about the prospect for job creation not being promising in slide 9 a worry. Now, we all know there's a downturn, there's a cyclical thing. There are also some consequences maybe of our own policies over the past. And it seems to me that while I very much welcome what you say as a matter of fact, that the prospects for job creation are not promising, that's a quote from the document, whether we can't handle that in a way which is stronger. Because again, it goes back to the Sona speech. We cannot accept a cyclical downturn as government, and particularly IDC, has a crucial role to play, as you indicated later on. Then there's the question of beneficiation in slide 17. There are two aspects to that, and one is a question. Comments by Neva Machetla and others about beneficiation of our minerals. She raises the question of job creation of capital intensity. Now, we do know that beneficiation is capital intensive, and it does affect the degree of emphasis that we place on that. But there are other elements in beneficiation which are critical. One of them is the question of resource depletion, and the second one is downstream activity. So can you maybe help us a little, since you do a lot of pay a lot of attention and your investment in beneficiation is quite strong. Can you comment on those two questions? One, resource depletion. Two, capital intensity versus or in addition to downstream value addition. Then one or two last points. The question of imports, the balance of payments and the balance on the trading account. You deal with this. Have you or has the department ever considered the question of import controls around luxury items, around items which are not essential? Because we are in a situation where our current account is being challenged internationally. It's one of our weak spots. And in fact, the rating agencies are always talking about that. So is there any suggestion that we might find ways of deliberately investing in industries, which I hesitate to use the word because it's not popular, import substitution. Because really, when we have a current account like we do, I know the theory about ISIs is not popular these days, but nevertheless, many countries are doing it. And does the IDC pay any attention to the fact that we have a current account which is in badly in balance, although it's improving for the reasons you state, but do you pay attention to investing in projects and industries which are input substituting precisely because we don't want to import as much as we do? Chair, I'm just one or two very quick points. Private sector investment is contracting. This is slide 13. Have you any comments on that? Because, you know, I think Parliament must pay attention to this question. Somebody pointed out that the state mustn't do everything. Well, of course, the state can't do everything. We're a mixed economy. There's a private sector and there's a state sector. But if the private sector investment is falling, as you say, then what do we do about it? And a comment from you would be helpful. Finally, the capital-based decline. This is a worry. And it seems to me your comment about the IDC not having government funding for a long time needs to be reviewed. And it seems to me Parliament must examine this question, whether the IDC should continue to be self-funding, relying on equity, so that if the stock exchange falls, your capital base falls, and then your consequential investment falls, is this satisfactory? And I would say, Chair, from the point of view of Parliament, it is not. And I think we should ask the Department and the Ministry to re-examine this principle. This principle. We're not saying that we must keep the IDC afloat by state funding, etc. I know the media are going to go mad on that one. But the question of your capital base declining, not because of inefficiency, but because the stock exchange has fallen in line with international developments, because some lunatics in America have behaved in a crooked manner with hedge funds and all that. I haven't got time to deal with it, but I think we all know what I'm talking about. It is not the fault of IDC that your capital base is declining. And I would say let the state and the ministry and the department look at that. And thanks for your indulgence.
Right. Thank you, Honourable Turok. Honourable Moreira.
Thank you, Chairperson. I'm only going to concentrate on the presentation that was made now and not other documents. Just two observations that I would just like your response to. Is it so that the majority of your funds you get in the capital market? And if so, or if not, where else do you get funding? And then can you give us an indication of your cost of funding? Because you have mentioned, preferential loans about, at prime less 5. That's one observation. The other one, on slide 27 about your large projects, you have mentioned electricity generation, involvement in Botswana but not South Africa. Now that sounds just strange to me if you look at the huge problems that we've got in South Africa and the money that will obviously be generated somewhere else and the cost involved in that. Now, that's a two observation. The two important questions I want to ask you, the first one is with regards to the jobs to be created. And I would very much like you to respond on that in relation to the undertaking by the President of jobs to be created, 500,000 towards the end of the year and many, many more after that. And this seems to be a drop in the bucket that you will provide. And whether that is realistic. The other question is the assistance to companies in distress. How do you decide on that? And what is the merits and the criteria for that? Is it on a first-come, first-served basis? How do you... Is it loans that you provide that must be repaid? Is it shares that you're taking up in those companies, and maybe specifically to a company called Frame that you seem to be identified that you're going to support, and it seems like it's on a or somehow a preferential basis that they got access to funding. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Honourable Maria. Honourable Kotsi, please.
Thank you, Chairperson. Chair, on slide 20. On medium-term objectives, I'm looking at the capital allocated for clothing, textile, leather, and so forth. My understanding with that sector is that it's one of the sectors that really went down when we had to compete with other countries. And I would think it's one of our most important ones to concentrate on, given the situations in the Western Cape and KwaZulu-Natal particularly, and it affects women. Why are we only capitalizing it with 1% and looking at the fact that it's also labor intensive, and you have indicated somewhere that it's one of our focus, and perhaps it's only 1%. The second one is on slide 23. You talk about expanding concept to township and mining revitalization, and I would want to know how. And at this point in time, I'm thinking of the illegal mining that is taking place in the Free State, and what do we do in terms of rehabilitating those mines? The problem is that we will not stop having those illegal mining activities taking place as long as there is no revitalization and actually other source of employment taking place in those towns. If you can go more, I mean, tell us more about how you intend doing that so that we as members of parliament can begin to say this is the beginning of actually stopping the illegal mining and more deaths taking place, particularly in areas of the Free State.
Thank you, Honourable Kotsi. I'm just going to ask the Honourable Maria to please just switch his mic off.
Okay.
Right. And also, Honourable Members on the committee, if there are any other questions, if we could have them now, because I'm really only looking at possibly one follow-up. So if there's anyone now who knows that they're going to be asking a question, thank you, Honourable Njakadana.
Number one, Chair. Whilst IDC may have made reference to engaging with the provincial FGIs, if I may say, and similar municipal agencies, it just could be helpful if Baba Kena can share with us quite specifically some of the success stories there. Because we have been briefed about those activities in the past, so unfortunately some of us would like to know the extent to which there are returns on that kind of investment. I mean, I was witness to the signing of the partnership with the Free State Development Corporation, just as an example. So one looks of interest that to what extent has that partnership, you know, brought dividends, if I can use commercial language. I think I'm being harassed yet. I say this because I also take into account what Professor Turuka said, the need for an institution of this nature like IDC to look at the major projects. Maybe what is linked to say that would my thinking be distorted that actually the lower band of the business community that SMMEs would be best served through these provincial FTIs and municipal agencies? This never is not clear. IDC can handle a 1 billion, 5 billion, 10 billion project with ease because of its capacity. Whereas at the same time, we have expectations IDC to look at the lower end as well. And I am biased to say that most probably these emerging partnerships with your FTC, ECDC, West, Grow, KII, and KZN, you know, that's where, because of IDC's capacity and expertise. Secondly, Chair, just to rush, but once again, I speak with questions, was it something that may be included here? To what extent has IDC, you know, sensitized itself and been focusing on participating or contributing to the reversal of deindustrialization? Because DTI has been fairly concerned about the consistent deindustrialization in the country. And once again, here is this institution that can capable to do that. If they could share with that. As well as agriculture, I see that reference has been made that there will be investment in agriculture. Now, there are two components in agriculture. There's primary agriculture, but also there is the industrial component in agriculture, which I think in South Africa we are still fairly thin on. Just as an interest, which are you, do you intend just investing as the applications for investments are coming, or will you be biased? Because there's land bank as well. Let me be open. Are you going to complement land bank? Maybe that's the inverse of the question. The last point is a little bit on the international. Once upon a time, DTI used to update us on the SADC economic integration, SADC now. What's the IDC's take in involving that? Or maybe rather a little bit specific, would the electricity generation venture and the sugar project in Tanzania be a component of that drive? But then what are the others? Because these are just two countries. My assumption says that whilst the SADC economic integration may have not been brought to its, say, maturity, surely we need to ensure that maybe there are a couple of projects that indicate that this is the route to which we can take as SADC. Thanks.
Thank you very much. Just a point from myself, the IDC, not necessarily for comments and so on, but quite clearly, as I said earlier, some of these policies are impacting directly on decent work creation in the trade and industrial area. And I noticed here your references to the geographical spread questions that have been raised. Such policies that aim to support small business, etc., do, I would hope, also aim to overcome the former spatial development patterns fostered by apartheid and so on in this area. But what we're going to do, and particularly for the Deputy Minister, Tobias's benefit just here coming in, is that if IDC can just respond to these questions succinctly, and if the Minister would want to just also make a comment, we'll move ahead on that basis, because we've only got 15 minutes left. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you to the members of the committee. I think the questions are always enlightening to us too, as well. I will take the approach the CEO of Kula took to ask for assistance from my fellow colleagues and to the DG. Let me address a couple, and then Lumkile Mondi will come in, and I think the DG would come in, particularly on the policy issues which have been raised as well. In terms of consciously saying what we do as far as beneficiation, I think it's an effort that we continually with our investments try and do, to say to what extent can we help ensure that beneficiation does indeed take place in South Africa. I mean, we help, for an example, the establishment of the State Diamond Trader precisely for that. But it's something that we continually do wherever we have investments, as a conscious effort that we can try and do that. What we try and balance is whenever we create capacity here, we have to ensure that in the long term, the business that we help establish has the ability to export to either to the African continent and but also to other countries as well. So we also bear that in mind, that if we create capacity here, it should not only be limited to what South Africa can just provide as a market, but it's something that we consciously do. In terms of our decline in capital, I think we would welcome that discussion. But as I said earlier on in the presentation, that there's still scope, in spite of the decrease in our capital base, there's still scope for us to extend a bit more, so, and then hence we're stretching that. But I think it's in the long term, it's something that we would welcome that debate to happen. In fact, I think the Minister has already indicated that we need to start thinking of that, particularly if we have to make a significant impact on these large projects that we have. In terms of how we fund ourselves. The source of funding, the large part, is from the internally generated income, from the investments that we have and the dividends and the interest. But also we go out and we borrow from either other development finance institutions. That's a big part of our borrowings, largely Europe and some of them in Asia. But we're starting to look at more into Asia now as well, particularly China. So we are looking at a number of those. In terms of the cost of funding, it's largely from the development finance institutions. It's LIBOR-based, so it depends on each institution that we negotiate with. It's a fluctuating rate, and hence we, to the best of our ability, we try and pass that benefit because we don't have the we don't take deposits, but it's not even our intention that we should do that. But we, because we're dealing with development finance institutions, we do find a relatively lower cost of funding than we find in the normal market. We have an element where we have some syndications where the commercial banks and other financial institutions would also participate, but that's a smaller part of our borrowing, but the bulk is from the development finance institution. Naturally, the cost of funding has increased as 2 years ago because of the decline we find ourselves in. In terms of the jobs that we create, in relation to the size that the president has mentioned, we do understand that if you look at it just on the direct jobs, it is not much. But I think we would like to believe with the size of balance sheet that we have, I mean, we do make an impact. But also it's the direct jobs that we're showing here. There's a multiplier effect, which I said. If you take in the indirect jobs as well, I think the numbers would be big. But it's something that we do take. The allocations, as I said, those are indicative, but if you look at the textile and clothing, it is indeed in our radar screen. It's in the National Industrial Policy Framework. So we have, it's in our radar screen. I think the size, because it's not as labor intensive as the others, so relative to those, and hence you would see that the allocation looks small relatively. But if you look at the how much we've already invested is in the portfolio, it's over 1.2 billion. I mean, in those, in slide 17, we have shown how much is in that sector. So it is the clothing and textile sector we have invested in. But it is a sector that we are aware that in terms of job creation, it is important. But also the effect it has on other industries as well. Our engagement with now we'll talk about the mining town rehabilitation. On our investments, our engagement with the local DFIs, we have seen varied successes. We have a number of agreements with them. What we find is the first step for most of these is really helping them upskill them in particular areas, for example, in risk management, in due diligence. So we've seen a great number of successes where they've come to the IDC. And they've seconded some of their people, not seconded really, they've brought in some of their people for training and because we're saying if they have the skills and they'll be able to then go out and when we partner with them and be much stronger than they would be. So we've done those for a number of them in Itala, in ECDC and all of those. But we've also started looking at co-investing with them. I mean, we're looking at opportunities where with ECIDC in particular, we've done some co-investment with them because we find that they also learn from that. I think because they are closer to those projects, I think it makes sense for them to do more so that we can indeed concentrate on the larger projects. But I think it's a process that will take time. Let me pause. Mkide will talk about particularly on the economic front issues.
Good morning. The South Africa is a rough and out country. So the sad part about our economic performance in the past 4 years is the failure for us to exploit the supernova. Commodity prices jumped very, very high at historical highs, and South Africa failed to exploit that opportunity. I think there's been a lot of discussion in the mining and in the mineral energy portfolio committee around why we failed. to exploit that high commodity price opportunity. It ranges from uncertainty around mining licenses and a lot of others. But really, as a DFI, it's quite important for us not to export these commodities raw as they are. It's to really value add on them. So as the IDC, we're at the forefront of it in making sure that we support private sector players in building in smelting, but also we go further, particularly as we discuss around advanced manufacturing, that we fabricate, we assist companies that are fabricating. Unfortunately, with the global turmoil, a lot of the markets have shrunk. Therefore, we position ourselves strategically, particularly around platinum, to make sure that we do build a smelter, given that we've got about 75% of world reserves around platinum. So we're looking at the project quite seriously around beneficiation and downstream. What we've done as well, on the gold sector, we've gone further by establishing a fund on the jewelry sector. Mr. Kreiner spoke about it. Because what we failed in doing was that, particularly for younger men and younger women who are looking at taking a partner, that buying jewelry locally is quite expensive. So therefore, to really, because a lot of it comes from Italy, America, who are very good at jewelry, particularly gold jewelry. So we felt that let's stimulate that sector by providing a fund. So I think hopefully in the medium to long term, for younger men and younger women, they'll have access to affordable jewelry because it will be done locally through the support of the IDC. I'm just talking about downstream beneficiation and access to that. One of the things we've seen, if you look at the balance of payments, things Professor Chukwuka was talking about, the deficit, particularly on the current account. If you analyze that deficit, you might have noticed that a lot of it is not necessarily driven by luxuries. Yes, on the motor car sector, you may find that a lot of luxurious cars, particularly the Mercedes-Benz, the luxurious Mercedes-Benz that you've seen the papers. But that's a joke. But if you look at the figures, Professor Chukwuka, if you look at the figures, you'll find that a lot of it relates to the capital expenditure that government is driving. Particularly on the transport sector through Transnet, the locomotive project, on the Eskom side, around the turbines, which then tells me to the other point that we're talking about, around deindustrialization and creating local capabilities around industry. And there, hopefully, with the developmental stage, we'll be able to coordinate SOEs to the IDC. Because without that, we're not going to be able to create industry. For example, turbines, highly capital intensive, high value added services, but we're not capable at all. Because partly deindustrialization, but also the lack of coordination among a developmental agenda of South Africa. So now that is there. We hope that ourselves, Eskom, and Transnet will be able to drive that agenda of creating that local industrial base, which we lost in the past 15 years. And lastly, it's not true that private sector investment or private sector has walked away. What we've seen on the private sector, in the past 6 years, private sector came to the power, the investment. And in the past 2 years, there's been a shift. Part of the shift, if you look at the balance sheet of a lot of private sector companies, they made a killing in the past 5 years. So those who had invested in these companies, those shareholders, have been smiling all the way to the banks because they've been paid a dividend. If you look in these companies, with a global meltdown, these companies have postponed those investment programs. So if you look in the steel sector, if you look in the cement sector, the PPCs, etc., they said, you know, we've been growing so much in the past 5 years, but going forward, because of lack of activity, if you look forward, they are now slowing down on capital investment, but they remain with cash. So the behavior in the rest of these companies, they're paying back huge dividends. You see in the steel sector, people just paying back a lot of money because there's no demand. So we believe that if there's demand, that should change going forward. Thank you.
Yes, I just want to appeal to the IDC if we can just constrain our response.
Thanks, thanks, Chair. It's the risk of allowing an economist to speak here. There's two responses I want to make, and then Nawa will just talk about the agencies. Why do a project in Botswana in electricity? We see power as having no boundaries. As we know, South Africa also imports from Mozambique. So it's part of that. It's not saying that because we're doing something in Botswana, we're not doing anything in South Africa. We're looking at a number of independent power producers projects in South Africa as well, also to supplement that. In terms of a frame, they have applied to us like any other investment. We're still busy in the process of looking at it. We have not approved it yet, but we're engaging with them to see whether it will indeed be approved. I think once that is done, I think a decision to that effect will be made, and I think the public would know. But at this stage, we're looking at that.
Good morning, Chairman. On the matter of development agencies and the revitalization of mining towns, the concept of the development agencies seems to have worked. The 23 that we have currently, some are, as we said, in development stage and some are already established and working. But the idea is to unlock investment potential, as you said, and to address the inequitable socio-economic development around those particular areas. We've expanded the concept to townships and mining towns or struggling mining towns. Some mines may be up for rehabilitation, that's well and good. I suppose that would fall under the mining department of mining. However, how we see it with the IDC, we actually have experienced this in a town not in what is now or was called Western Area. We had a partnership with a mining house where we actually provided some capital together with them providing the land, and we actually diversified away from mining so that the economic advantage of that particular town is not just pinned on mining, especially if mining is declining in that particular area, and that's the intention. It's a relatively new strategy for us at this point. We've only been doing this for last couple of months. We're working with the Free State in particular to establish one of the towns, literally Buza in particular, as one of our pilot studies. In terms of the townships, we have partnered with JDA, the Johannesburg Development Agency, towards the rehabilitation of Soweto. There's a complex, tourism complex that we've partnered with JDA. That's the first one. We're now working on Muregeli outside of Pretoria to actually do a similar thing. Find the economic advantages of the area. It is a depressed area because the bulk of the people there actually have to work in Pretoria but live in Muregeli, and there isn't anything happening around there. So that's the intention. Relatively new, but I think we'll have better results about these two particular projects in the next presentation.
Thanks, Chair. I think if the DG has any responses, but from us, I think we've covered most of those.
I would like just to check with the Minister, Deputy Minister, if she would just like to make an input here.
Yes, Chair, I need to apologize for my voice because I left it in my hometown this weekend, but I think I'll respond to one or two political questions that I heard from the members after the DG has responded.
Yes, please go ahead, and congratulations on your appointment officially, Deputy Minister Thandi Tobias Bakolo.
Okay. Now you are making me shy. I wanted to find out whether the DG wanted to say something.
DG?
No, some of the issues that Honorable Turok raised, perhaps we'll pick them up in the context of our presentation, beneficiation, import controls,
that kind of thing, the capitalization of the IDC. I suggest we do that, Chair. But I do want to dispose of one quick issue, which was why we were not at the BRICS summit, and the answer is that we were not invited. The Russian Federation, who are supposed to be our strategic partner, as you know, in the IPSA, we work very closely with Brazil and India, and logically, therefore, ought to have been part of that. Of that summit. So I think this is a matter that, from a diplomatic perspective, the International Relations and Cooperation Department should look into. We must be in that club. We belong there. Thanks.
And on the same issue that the DG has spoken about, I think we'll remember that next week. The minister and myself are attending the OECD, and part of what will happen there is that the minister will have a forum with BRICS, so it's not a foregone opportunity. Well, I'm trying to win the attention of the chairperson at the same time. The second issue that I wanted to respond to is that we should also remember that government is intending to build a state-owned mine as part of the priorities to ensure that we do not let mining in South Africa deteriorate. And part of the interventions that government has intended to put on the table has been presented by the Public Enterprise Committee. I think it should have been discussed at that level. And one other issue that I thought I must make a comment on was on the FTC. I think it has been clear that there have been challenges with the FTC, but in terms of how it operated, there is a shift in focus. It did not deal much with small enterprise development as part of its mandate. It used to provide loans to small businesses without incubation in the past. But if you look at how it has intended to bring around the situation, it will focus more on its core mandate. I think we need to interact with its current strategic objectives to look at what it wants to achieve. There's a question that has not been answered, which I still prefer that it should be answered, about how are we going to deal with distressed companies. I think it's not a free-for-all situation. We'll look at the type of impact that these companies will do in the economy. I think we should have an intensive debate, because I know it's a question that the DA on a regular basis will want to ask. And the minister has spoken about this, if you remember in his response, that we will focus only on those that are having a huge impact in the economy. Chair, I think those are the last question. It was asked by Mr. Jigela about how are we going to deal with issues of deindustrialization. One of the challenges that has been identified is skills shortage. And part of the ministerial priorities is to increase our skills capacity in the country to be able to deal with challenges. Of course, there's a draft industrial policy, of which we should have a debate at some point between ourselves and the committee, so that we can also solicit inputs from the portfolio committee. So let's look at that as it stands, and further enhance that document to ensure that we cover the base that the committee has face the challenges. Chair, I think those are the few questions I wanted to respond to, because I needed to spare my voice so that I can recuperate. Thank you.
I'd like to thank the Deputy Minister, but at the same time, I would also like to thank Mr. Geoffrey Quenner and the IDC team. And thank you very much. And at this stage, I know that members, and I know that everyone is hungry and whatever, but obviously man does not live on bread alone. And our purpose here is to engage, and that is the priority at the moment. So we will call the DG of Trade and Industry, and that is Mr. Chadiso Matona, to present to us the departmental
the DTI presentation on both 32 and the strategic plan.
Yeah, before that, I wanted to tell the economists that young people have decided on certain services days because they cannot afford drinks. And the deputy minister and myself are not driving Mercedes-Benzes.
Certainly, for the information of those who are interested, I drive a 57-year-old car, Morris Minor, which is quite capable of getting me from A to B, and I have no intentions of getting beyond that. Far more reliable than the Benzes I've seen on the side of the road. Now, if we can just indicate how this program is working. We are going to engage now with the vote itself and the strategic plan. It's 12:45, and this will go on until, 12:45, it is 11:45, and this will go on until 12:40. And we hope that all sides will focus on brevity. Thank you. Over to you, DG.
Thank you very much, Chair. I believe because the documentation on which we are presenting was already circulated, tabled in Parliament, the members will have familiarized themselves with its contents, and therefore I could be quite quick in terms of my presentation. We were asked to incorporate as much as possible the inputs of the agencies because there wouldn't be any opportunity to engage with them individually, at least for now. And so we have tried to do that. That has expanded the presentation somewhat. But I believe that, you know, that much of that information could be taken as background. The relevant CEOs and chairs are here to pick up on issues of detail that may arise. And so what I will do is to focus at a very high level on the framework, the strategic framework of the work of the department in the period ahead of us. The plans that you will be looking at, the members, were conceived on the basis of the budget process. As you know, we do have a draft medium-term expenditure framework. And so much of what we have planned was conceived on that basis. That's a process that was undertaken in the lead-up to the elections. We have tried to anticipate what the new mandate, the new political mandate, and the priorities arising out of that, and in specific areas I will indicate that. We've also been involved in processes of aligning the programs of government with the mandate, starting with the cabinet lekgotla that happened a few weeks ago, and much of this featured in our presentation to the lekgotla. The outline of the presentation is as indicated. I will quickly go through the vision that we've set ourselves and our objectives, and I'll do a quick overview of the economy because I think the IDC presentation and our own presentation does deal with some of the key issues in regard to the crisis that we confront now as an economy. And then I will look at the pillars of the DTI strategy and the specific actions that we're proposing to undertake going forward. We will then look at the resources that have been allocated, the numbers thereof, and then conclude by highlighting some of the challenges that we will be dealing with. I do need to say, Chair, that one of the areas around which there could be a modification of our plans and reorganization is in relation to our relationship as a department with the new Department of Economic Planning, in terms of what will be the allocation, the division of responsibilities, and the demarcation of mandates as such. That's still work in progress, and I do expect that once we have that bedded down, the program of action of the DTI will probably look slightly different. This is our vision. I won't spend too much time. I think it's self-explanatory. It remains a very relevant vision. Of course, we will be constantly reviewing it to check for alignment with the new mandates of government. But we do believe that the core objectives of growth and employment and equity are consistent throughout, and indeed they are consistent in the political mandate of this new administration. In terms of mission, again, also consistent, where we seek to establish the DTI as one of the leading departments in the area of economic development, playing different roles of understanding the complexities of the economy, the challenges of the economy, developing programs and instruments that would catalyze the development of the economy, tackling issues of transformation and establishing an environment that is supportive of the vision of government. Our strategic objectives are indicated there. We will be playing a critical role in regard to implementation, and the emphasis will be on implementation of programs in the area of economic development. Policy issues will clearly be part of a much wider process in which we expect the new Economic Development Department to play a central role, as well as the other structures that have been established in government, such as the Planning Commission in the Presidency and so on. Our programs will focus on promoting investment and growth, dealing with issues of industrial development, as well as focusing on the services economy with a central objective of being employment creation. And indeed, the political mandate emphasizes the concept of decent work. That will be a concept that we will be engaging with. In fact, we already started to unpack what that means for the department. Issues around exports and promoting equitable global trade, mainly principally through the work in the World Trade Organization, issues of promoting broader participation, equity and redress, which speaks to issues of enterprise development, and including marginalized people, marginalized enterprises, and marginalized regions in the mainstream of the economy. And then, of course, the work that we will have to do in regard to the continent. In regard to the overview of the economy, I won't spend too much time on this, Chair, because I think much of this is known, the fact that as a result of the global economic crisis, we are in a recession, and it's a recession that is affecting jobs in a massive way. Job losses are continuing on an ongoing basis, and this indeed challenges the industrial economy. If you look at manufacturing, sharp declines in manufacturing in every sector of the 39 industrial subsectors, there's been massive declines. We indicate that a direct challenge to our efforts in regard to decent employment is that even labor-intensive sectors are under pressure, and that manufacturing capacity is under threat as a result of massive closures of companies and firms. We already last year, anticipating this crisis, were part of a process led from the presidency with stakeholders, business and labour, within the framework of NetLeg, where we negotiated a framework which is called a framework for South Africa's response to the international crisis. The president referred to this in State of the Nation address. Our work in the immediate period in regard to responding to the crisis will be shaped by the commitments that we have reached in that framework. It outlines immediate and urgent interventions to protect the economy against the damaging effects of the crisis, focusing mainly on maintaining the program of public investment, from which we expect that much economic activity will derive from, as well as job creation. Looking at macroeconomic policies, the contribution that they can make, and we've recently seen a lot of activism in regard to interest rates, activism in the right direction, and indeed some of the remarks of the Reserve Bank governors have been quite pertinent in regard to the effects of monetary policy on the real economy. The other focus area will clearly be on instruments which are in the department, and I will at a later stage deal with those in detail in regard to industrial and trade policies, as well as programs in the area of public works, the expanded public works program, which clearly promises to help us with dealing with the employment challenge. Now, there are specific things that the department will have to look at in the context of that framework. The first one is in the area of access to finance, and here there will be a particular focus on the role of DFIs and the IBC, as you've heard, has already been preparing to play a much sharper, much direct role, I think, in helping companies with things like bridging finance and so on. So there's a framework that's been developed that's very important as part of this work. We will need to look at plugging holes in our import regime, particularly as regards activities like under invoicing, illegal imports and dumping, which undermine local industries, and that require our attention, working with the customs authorities as such. I think the issue of import policy more generally is a much bigger issue, and I think that the question that Honourable Turok raised draws attention to what policy, beyond what I've referred to, what policy direction do we envisage in regard to the protection of the economy to stimulate industrial development? I think it's a big issue that we are engaging with, but I'll say something about that a bit later. For the rest of the work we will do, we will be looking at how we leverage the capital expenditure program of government, particularly in terms of procurement, ensuring that we procure from the domestic economy and we use this program to stimulate industries that can contribute to our industrialization and addressing issues of jobs. The issue of competitiveness and the incentives that are in the department trying to deploy those more effectively, more strategically to assist with the crisis. And then, of course, dealing with cartels, which also create constraints to dynamizing the economy and creating opportunities for expanding the industrial base. The issue of protection will be global protectionism in terms of the responses of our trading partners to the crisis and the threats that poses will require our attention, working through the World Trade Organization and other avenues. And then, of course, the idea of looking to expanding our exports in non-traditional markets, and this refers to large markets like India, Brazil, cooperating a lot more closely with those countries to diversify our links, because part of our problem is because our trade links are lopsided, too lopsided, in the direction of the Eurozone and North America and Japan. This is further issues around the work in this area. We will clearly be working with the other government departments in terms of the new clusters in government, and we detail out some of the approaches we will be adopting in regard to that. And as I said, Chair, the IDC presentation has further details on some of the ways in which the crisis is manifesting itself in South Africa. I do want to move very quickly to deal with the framework for the work of the department in the period ahead. We've organized our work through the themes that are indicated there. Industrial development will continue to be the leading flagship set of activities in the department. Trade, investment and exports is another area that speaks really to how we integrate with the rest of the world. The issues of foreign participation, another theme, regulation, as well as administration and coordination. In these areas, Chair, our work will be to design relevant and robust programs and policies, as well as services and offerings, looking at the role of our agencies in these areas, as well as our links with other government departments. In the area of industrial development, the key focus of the department over the next 3 years will be to implement the industrial policy framework through a set of action plans, and we are in the process of developing a new set of actions to take further this work. In the preceding period, we targeted a number of sectors: automotive, capital equipment, forestry and furniture, clothing and textiles, and so on. We are now looking at how we scale up some of those actions so that we can achieve a greater impact in our work. We will look at the issue of the technical infrastructure, dealing with the standards, quality and accreditation, and some of the agencies working with us in this area are in their room, and I'm sure if there are any issues in regard to that, they will assist. The issue of giving our work in the region a much stronger industrial development component. So far the focus has been on tariffs, border measures, as it were. We haven't necessarily focused on building industrial capacities and cooperation in the region. The issue of incentives here we'll be looking at how we enhance the impact of a suite of incentives, and I will outline what those are in a moment. From the point of view of their relevance to our industrial policy objectives, issues of job creation, exports, how we accommodate the special circumstances of firms that are in distress, how we deal with issues of turnaround times, which are really service delivery issues. Then the work that will focus on our initiatives in the area of industrial development zones. Now, these are specially designated areas where we wish to build critical infrastructure that will encourage particular activities, industrial manufacturing activities, and especially those that have the possibility of exporting. And so there are a few of these areas that we've designated that we've been working on. We will want to advance that work, dealing with some of the challenges around governance and resourcing those initiatives. Here are the list of incentive programs that we have on offer in the department, and we've set ourselves a target on the number of companies that we would like to support. These are dealing with the promotion of exports and investment, the promotion of business outsourcing and offshoring, which is a new industry that we've launched and is developing pretty well. We will continue to attract investments in this area, particularly in the context of the global economic crisis, whereby opportunities for growth are presented by the restructuring that companies in the countries that are affected will be engaged in. So there are opportunities for us that we'll be on the lookout for in the context of this crisis. The Black Business Supplier Development Program seeks to support Black entrepreneurs, mainly with marketing material. The Enterprise Development Program is a new initiative focusing on incentivizing and small enterprises in particular sectors, particularly those that are at the core of our industrial policy programs. Cooperatives, we have a scheme to promote cooperatives that we will be looking at growing to maximize its impact. And then, of course, the tax incentive, which has recently been launched together with the National Treasury. We hope to be using that to encourage investment. For the rest, it will be the specific targets, Chair, that we hope to achieve in each of these areas. I'm not going to spend too much time on that. I'll move to the next area, which is trade, investment, and exports. This really speaks to the policies and strategies that we will adopt in relation to the rest of the world and the specific institutional arrangements in that context. We will be looking at promoting greater alignment of our international engagements with our industrial development objectives to ensure that that creates a conducive environment for us to grow our exports, particularly exports of high value goods. We'll be looking at deepening our links with the economies of the South, China, India, and Brazil, where we have already established mechanisms, and there's a program of work going on in regard to IPSA. We will be looking at how we scale some of these initiatives up so that they can create the basis for us to diversify our trade links with the rest of the world. Of course, Europe and America remain important. We have existing arrangements there that we will continue to maximize the free trade agreement we have with the Europeans, the so-called Trade Development and Cooperation Agreement, the TDCA, the Africa Growth and Opportunity Framework, which allows us to export duty-free to the U.S. market, remains very, very important. We will continue to monitor treaties around non-proliferation, which really deals with the trade in armaments and weapons of mass destruction. We will conclude key agreements that establish frameworks for us to trade with the world, focusing on Africa under the auspices of the African Union, as well as building key infrastructure programs to facilitate regional integration, the so-called spatial development initiatives, expanding those to countries in our neighborhood, countries like Angola and Namibia, building on the very successful spatial development initiative we have with Mozambique. The regional integration program of the department faces particular challenges because on the one hand we want to take the South African Development Community, SADC, forward as well as SACU, but on the other the outcomes of the negotiations of these countries with Europe and the fact that they have went along to conclude an agreement with Europe that we don't think is beneficial to ourselves nor to these countries does present particular challenges, and it will be something, at least in policy terms, that will require our engagement. The WTO process is an important one. We will continue to insist on an outcome in the negotiation that is advances the objective of development and ensures that developing countries are meaningfully integrated into the trade system. We have embarked on negotiations for a preferential trade agreement with India, which we would like to advance. With the rest of the continent, there is a decision reached by the heads of states of South Africa and Tanzania and other countries in the region to say, let us bring our regional organizations together so that we can create larger markets in our continent. It doesn't help us creating regional economic communities that end up competing with each other. So this is a bold initiative which we will continue to work on. The International Trade and Administration Commission manages our tariffs, and we will need to be looking at how they strengthen their activities to protect the economy, as I indicated earlier. So the department provides strategic direction to the work of this entity. We will need to review our trade policies to look at where there is scope to provide protection, because our tariffs are regulated by the World Trade Organization, and we've made particular commitments which limit the extent to which we can use the tariffs. And in a sense, I'm addressing myself to the question that Honorable Turok raised, whether there is scope to raise the tariffs. Now, of course, any country can raise the tariff as it wishes. And if in the area of luxury goods we would like to do that, I think we will need the political courage to do that. Because the raising of tariffs is something that generally is frowned upon. And it's the whole philosophy of the World Trade Organization is that we need to open trade, and that protection is not an optimal policy approach. And I think many countries have followed this, because there are forms of protection that have been damaging. And in our case, we have tended to protect industries that have, as a result, become highly uncompetitive. And so, in the initial period of our trade policy, the objective was to encourage greater competition. And the assumption was that we will make available supply side and other instruments to help these companies to withstand competition, to become more competitive as such. Well, the question is, looking back, you know, have we succeeded? And I think that there are strong views that that the companies have taken a beating from intense competition, and we have not necessarily succeeded in supporting them. And that as a result, our industrial base is a lot weaker, and hence, therefore, the emphasis in the work on the industrial development is precisely to do that, to help strengthen, protect our industrial base. And if there is still scope in the tariff, we should be prepared to do that. But of course, I must say that in the context of the World Trade Organization, if you raise a tariff beyond the permitted level, the level that you've committed yourself to, then you must expect that your trading partners will retaliate. So we do need a strategic cost and benefit analysis. I can't see how we can raise tariffs against luxury goods that come from the EU or from America and still expect them to give us access, duty-free access to our products. Many manufactured products enter America and Europe free of duty, and that makes a great deal of difference in the competitiveness of these countries and in supporting jobs in these industries, as it were. So, we will have to make an assessment of, on balance, where should we lean in terms of policy in regard to that. But it is something which the minister has been speaking a lot about this. So it's not going to be an ideological position. Where there's evidence that a tariff, a particular tariff, can contribute to strengthening a particular industry, we will go in the direction of protecting that sector. Equally, where removing a particular tariff is useful, such as, for example, in lowering input costs and so on, we should also be prepared to do that. And that will be, I think, the approach that we will take in regard to this area. For the rest, I think I shouldn't spend too much time, because this speaks to some of the promotional activities of the department in regard to exports and investment, the whole area of supporting new exporters, because the challenge we have is that we don't have a sufficient number of exporting enterprises. So growing our export is also going to require for us to grow the number of exporters in the economy. For the economy of our size, the number of companies that are exporting is still very limited. And this is something that the activities indicated there will deal with. Coming to the broadening of participation, Chair. Here, the work we've undertaken up to so far has focused on the area of enterprise development, and that speaks to small, medium, and micro enterprises, because we have programs for each of these enterprises. We have begun to develop instruments for cooperatives as well, and as I mentioned, I think the area of cooperatives is one where we haven't made the kind of progress that we ought to have made, and so it will be a focus. But the key area, which has also been a challenging area, has been in regard to BEE. I think that the objective of increasing participation of black people in the economy remains an important objective, which we will continue to pursue through the legislation around BEE and the codes of good practice. We have now gotten to a point where we've put in place the measurement framework for BEE, and I think that we should allow that framework to operate with appropriate monitoring and evaluation. And a key area that needs to be addressed in this regard is the establishment of the advisory council, the BEE advisory council. That would be the next major step, I think, in putting dispensation for BEE. The rest of the slides indicate the activities of our agencies, the NEF, which is dedicated to promoting empowerment, and some of their targets are indicated there. I'm not going to go through them. Members can read them on their own. In the area of small enterprise development, key agency of the department there is CEDA. The targets are indicated there. And in the area of microfinance, SAMAF, whose activities are also indicated. I do want to move to a critical area, which is the area of regulation. Chair, we have undertaken a massive program recently, which have resulted in new entities, regulatory entities being proposed. Currently there are 9 so far dealing with different areas, and I will indicate some of these entities going forward, but the key initiatives that the department will take forward is in the implementation of the new set of legislation that we have recently taken before Parliament and has been passed by Parliament, the Companies Act, which completely revitalizes corporate governance and repositions the whole area of corporate governance in South Africa. I think this modernizes corporate governance in ways that will prevent some of the scandals in regard to corporate governance that we've seen, starting with Fidentia a few years ago, and now this recent one, this pyramid scheme that has been exposed. So the area of strengthening corporate governance in South Africa is a critical one. And we believe that this act enables us to achieve that, as well as to open up opportunities for small enterprises. Consumer protection is another area where we've introduced new legislation, as well as in the area of competition protection and competition law. The Competition Act awaits assenting by the President, but Parliament has pronounced itself fairly clearly and fairly decisively on the need to strengthen the enforcement capacity and authority of the competition institutions to deal with what appears to be fairly pervasive, collusive behavior, collusive conduct in the economy. The successes of the competition authority lead us to believe that the practice is much more deep-seated, and that we need to strengthen our competition law. And so some of the work we'll be doing, it will be to actually implement this new act. And then, of course, there is work around the review of intellectual property protection dispensation in South Africa, starting with taking forward this Intellectual Property Laws Amendment Act, which proposes to protect indigenous knowledge, as well as reviewing the Lotteries Act of 1997. It's over 10 years of experience with this act, and we've seen some of the challenges that it presents us, and I think it's timely that we review it with a view to dealing with some of these challenges. Again, for the rest, the specific plans of the agencies that operate in this space, Chair, I will not spend too much time on them. I think they're self-explanatory, and as I indicated, the CEOs and chairs of the boards of these entities are here, so I won't spend too much time on those. I'll go to the last focus area of our work, which is on administration. The first issue we refer to is the importance of communication and marketing of the work of the department. Fairly extensive set of programs, set of activities. We need to do a better job of communicating this, particularly to constituencies that are underserved in terms of communicating our offerings and services to them. And as well as repositioning the role of the department, I think, in the economy, particularly in the light of the establishment of a new ministry. A lot of people are asking, what will the DTR now become? What will be the role of the DTR relative to this new department? I think we are going to have to do some communicating once we've clarified what the precise demarcation of roles is going to be. Otherwise, there could be a lot of room for confusion out there in the market. The other set of issues in this area relate to what remains long-standing challenges of attracting the right kind of skills into the work of the department, dealing with the challenges of turnover of staff, and establishing a strong framework of performance management in line with the emphasis on service delivery and effectiveness. So we set ourselves a set of objectives in regard to that area, but also how the department can contribute to some of government's objectives in regard to equity, particularly as regard to disability and empowerment. We also hope to strengthen corporate governance in the department, focusing on information security as well as fraud and other areas of risk. The rest of the presentation, Chair, deals with the actual allocations, budgetary allocations. Again, the figures there, they speak for themselves in terms of the programs of the department, the allocations. This slide indicates how the budget of the department is cut up. 7.8% of the our budget goes to compensation of employees. 9.4% goes to goods and services, and that is the framework within which we undertake new initiatives and so on. For the rest, 20% goes to our agencies, 61% goes to incentives, and 1% goes to capital projects. This graph shows a historical pattern of our budget. You will see that consistently we've been spending the budget that is allocated to the department. This year, this last financial year, our under expenditure is 1%. And I think what this actually means is that the department is ready to absorb new resources, massive resource increases to expand our capacity so we can up our game, as it were, in regard to the mandate that is expected of us. A few things require attention as we go forward. I think we will need to strengthen monitoring and evaluation, and I do hope that the dispensation that has been put in place in the presidency will assist us in doing better monitoring and evaluation of the impact that the department is having in regard to areas like enterprise support, jobs, and so on. Clearly, Parliament will continue to play an important role. We look forward to establishing a cooperative, supportive relationship with Parliament. There will be a number of other things that are important, how we work with stakeholders, the forums that are created for us to engage with stakeholders, as well as the clusters. And of course, service delivery, improving service delivery will continue to become an important focus of the department. And I can explain what that means in the discussion. Here we give a list of some of the challenges. I've already referred to some of them. I will not repeat them, Chair, and that concludes our presentation. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Matona, but also to your full staff, strategic members of staff as well. At this stage, members, I do want to take some questions, keeping you on board all the time. Just to indicate, the Minister will be joining us shortly and we won't forget lunch. Let's take some questions. Right, members. I saw the Honourable Turok, the Honourable Murray, and members, is that a hand?
No, just a wave. Thank you.
Thanks very much. Given the importance and, in fact, the unique event of the framework document of NEDLAC, can't we ask the DTI to produce this in large volumes and to make it available to the whole country? It's a unique document, and it, as you indicated, and it's in your presentation, etc., I think it's so important that we do need bulk copies. Secondly, the Competition Commission, I think they're doing a tremendous job, and certainly one would like to see them get more funding, but I do want to say that the energy that they bring to the their particular mandate is highly appreciated. On procurement, I would like to get a lot more information on your procurement policy. I'd like to, in fact, I would like to, in future, when as time allows, to interrogate your procurement policy, your tender policy. I think we need to open that up a great deal, bearing in mind that the PFMA is often an obstacle and is often imposes very onerous conditions. Nevertheless, in the light of some of the public explosions recently, I think the question of tenders and procurement does require a lot more transparency, and I'm afraid I'm going to draw attention to that. On protectionism, thanks very much for your comments, and was even-handed on the one hand, on the other. That's the way we need to handle it. Clearly, we need flexibility, and we need to be pragmatic, and we need to be constantly aware of the dangers of going too far. At the same time, one needs a development model to guide us. So flexibility, pragmatism by all means. And I think that we're lacking that model. There are certain, you know, UNCTAD has come out with so many analyses of what works and what works best. And it's based on, if you like, a theoretical development model. And so flexibility and pragmatism, yes. But let's do it in a context of some sort of theoretical understanding of what's going on. Otherwise, you just fix and mend and so on. And I want to say quite frankly that we followed the wrong model in 95-96. We went far too, much too far in reducing our tariffs. And our bound rates were laid down by the WTO. We went much too far, and I think, frankly, I think we should not hesitate to reverse where this has been harmful, also always on the basis of pragmatism and flexibility. Then on BEE, I'm afraid that we should be a little bit more critical. You know, the fact of the matter is that in the country as a whole, BEE has been seen as a failure. It hasn't been broad-based, and this committee changed the legislation from BE to triple B. It has not happened on any large scale, and there's a huge unease in the country. May I suggest that some mechanism to review the whole thing? I mean, frankly, the codes, the rules that you've produced as a department, we complained about that many times, far too cumbersome. You need so many lawyers and accountants to be able to go through it. I think really the time has come for a total review, and I would urge that. So thank you very much. That's all I wanted to say.
Thank you, Honourable Turok. Honourable Marais.
Thank you, Chair. I have picked up, I think over the weekend, that the Minister has indicated a revision of the industrial development policy. I'm not quite sure whether it's fair to ask you to comment to that or if you want to, because the Minister will be later on with us. Then in terms of the, I'll just mention it here, the SACU problem, where we have seen that some of our neighbours has entered into a separate custom unions agreement with European countries, because that holds massive problems, potential problems for us also in terms of illegal imported goods or undervalued imported goods into via those countries. If you can just comment on that. Then also on the BEE, I cannot but agree with
Honourable Turok on the fact that BE is not broad-based, it's not successful, it's certainly not achieving the objectives, and I think it should be revisited. Also, what is very important is that we see the preferential procurement policies, but the preferential procurement policies is not aligned with the broad-based back economic empowerment policies. And surely that is causing, I know on the local government level, it's causing massive problems. People that is supposed to be BEE accredited or qualified does not comply with their requirements. Then lastly, just on the budget, where 61% is to incentive payments. Can you give us more clarity in terms of what type of incentive payments are we talking about there and how that is maybe spread and divided? Thank you very much. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Honourable Marais. Are there any other questions? I do see one. Thank you. Honourable Njakalana?
Thanks, Chair. Well, number one, a lot of reference is made to trade policy. But if I could just remind that late 2007, we were presented with an export strategy. And in that meeting, reference was made that a refined trade policy will be presented. Now we're almost 18 months, if not 20 months down the line. Through you, Chair, Kasku, to Barry Kolot, we definitely would be very, very keen to get, Chair, a skeleton. Yes. Why I'm raising this is because obviously intensity in trade, particularly under this current climate, you know, is more than obvious. So we really need to know where we stand in terms of trade policy. The same goes with incentive scheme. At some stage, mid-2007, Dr. Matuna, a brilliant presentation on refinement or renewal of incentive schemes was presented to us at Max Building. Once again, yes, colored. The same with investment climate. Some time ago, one comrade came and presented to us with a brilliant articulation of the investment climate. I'm sorry, Chair, it's just scales that I'm talking about now. That goes with the National Business Advisory Council, which has never come to this committee. The same with REITs, Regional Industrial Development Strategy. I'm raising this, Chair, because I see them as building blocks that at the end of the day, once we take them on board, we're able to see the extent to which we're moving as one of the sectors of the economic clusters or one of the components of the economic cluster. A question for me, amongst others, is time and again we make reference to the coordinating role of DTI on the economic cluster. And it's very fundamental that once again not only the DG, but also the minister update us on their coordinating role of the economic cluster. Even new departments have been established now. We've expressed concern in the past. We've been given responses to an extent convinced, to an extent also not convinced. And I would even go to the extent of proposing that this item becomes a standing item, or this issue becomes a standing item when we interact, because economic development in its entirety or in a comprehensive sense cannot be driven by DTI. So we need to have an understanding as to how other components, which is other departments, are either reinforcing or mutually reciprocating the work that's being done by DTI. From time to time, even through media or from ourselves, we'll throw scat missiles at DTI. And at times, unfortunately, for things that are supposed to be done by other departments, hence we need to understand what then does DTI do, because it has been assigned with the duty of coordinating the economic cluster as a whole. Just as a comment to reinforce what Comrade Turok has said, I think at some stage we need to really commend and even monitor the regulatory component of DTI more closely. The National Consumer Commission, the tribunal, and the credit regulators, because those institutions actually help to clean, if I can use that term, they help to clean the economy because of these distortions that are taking place. The frauds, price fixing, and stuff. And I trust and hope this time, in this term, we're going to be fairly robust to ensuring that they are equally capacitated. Thank you.
Right. I think at this point, if we could get the responses from DTI so that at 5 to 1 we could take a short luncheon break and then return here at 1:15. So over to the DG, please.
Thank you, Chair. I'll quickly deal with these questions, and if any of my colleagues and agencies that have been referred to wish to come in, I hope they can do so. I agree with Honourable Turok that to the extent that much of what we are going to be doing in the immediate term will be informed by this document, the framework, we do need to publicize it. The President referred to it in his State of the Nation speech, and I think it's only natural that I think we should publicize it. I do want to say that there was doubt initially, which has now been cleared, as to whether the government had applied its mind to that document, because it was a product of negotiation by officials of different departments.
Yeah, may just come in there. It's published in the name of the presidency.
Yes.
It's published in the name of the president, so this is not just...
Yes.
And may I say that I'm publishing it in full in the new agenda in the next issue.
Okay. All right. No, I wanted to precisely say that the fact that the president pronounced himself in the way he did on it disposes of any doubt whatsoever as to what that document is. We have already factored in our plans, as I indicated, many of the commitments that pertain to the DTI in our plans going forward. So I think it's a comment that's taken on board. We should put it on our website and ensure that. I know COSATU, I actually go around with a very nice copy that COSATU did of the document for its own part. But I think we do need to make it widely available. I agree with that. We are also very satisfied with the work of the competition authorities. We think they're on the right track. And in the budgeting process, we made a very strong bid for the capacity of the authorities to be enhanced. And I must say, this is one area, we didn't get everything, we don't always get everything, but this is one area where I thought that the Treasury responded, because I think they also appreciate the positive work of the competition authority. We will ensure that we take this work to a higher level, because as I said, our suspicion is that the collusion is much more pervasive than might appear. And so we will take that on board indeed. We are quite happy to share perhaps at another opportunity with yourself the tender process of the department. Now, as you know, this area is governed by treasury regulations and treasury statutes, and we are, and it's audited. When our financials are done, the Auditor General checks whether our procurement has been in line with the requirements and so on. And indeed, as you know, if there's anything amiss, you get a qualification. There must be something that we do right, Chair. We haven't had an audit qualification. At least not since I've been in this position over the last 4 or 5 years. And so we're very proud. We maintain very high standards of transparency in our tender and procurement policies. To a very large extent, I think the same applies to our agencies. A few of our agencies, I can't even remember which of our agencies has had an audit qualification. But I think I accept the point you're raising, because recently, indeed, it does appear that this area, sometimes problems arise with regard to the way tenders are allocated and so on. And so every time a challenge like that arises, it gives us the opportunity to look at how we improve. But we are prepared to share how we align with legislation, the BEE, procurement from previously disadvantaged, and so on. So we have that detail. We can provide it at the right time. I think, Honorable Turok, you raise a very important comment, I think, around our trade policy. Because indeed, part of our problem is that the current commitments that we undertook in the World Trade Organization were undertaken just immediately before 1994. And that was when South Africa in the World Trade Organization was classified as a developed country. And I think that's created a problem for us because, as you correctly observed, the extent to which we have opened the economy has not been matched by success in supporting industries in terms of their competitiveness and so on. Our industries are exposed, but they're not sufficiently competitive. And that does require us to review our trade policy. And I think the remarks I made earlier about what approach will be in this area apply. In other words, will be guided by evidence as to which way to review tariffs. But I know that the work on trade policy review, which is to deal with the question of Honourable Njikela, is ongoing. It's a consultative process. But the DDG, Karim, is here because this is a project that he leads, so he may be able to indicate much more specifically as to when we will conclude this work, which hopefully will deal with some of the issues that he raised, which I agree with are important. I think that in regard to BEE, I think that, yes, we accept as well as a department that the outcomes have not been consistent with the policy intentions. The policy intentions have been to ensure broadness of BEE. Now, I think we need, a lot of this is obviously based on anecdotal evidence, because the deals that get publicized are those that feature the same old people, and they're all about ownership. But I think we need to give ourselves an empirical basis to decide how we review BEE, or which direction we review BEE to. And I know that there was an initial study that was done that indicated success in some areas, particularly on the broadness, the elements of broadness, which is procurement, enterprise development, skills development, and so on. That in some instances they have been successful, but that overall, I think that in the private sector especially, no success, I think, in regard to broadness, and that we still have some way to go. But it is also worth emphasizing, Chair, that a government itself needs to look at how we implement BEE, because BEE, in fact, in the way it was conceived, was for the government to lead, and hence the importance of procurement as an instrument, licensing, and those things, the instruments in the what you call it were meant to be, and that in the private sector we would create incentives such as what we've created by way of the codes, as well as the sector charters and so on. But BEE was actually meant to be led by the state. And so this review must look at what have been the role of the state. And I'm not talking about changing the management composition of senior excellence of government and so on, because there's no doubt we've succeeded, but whether, you know, in terms of procurement and so on, licensing, and whether we so we have a comprehensive picture of BEE. Needless to say that the codes, the dispensation itself has a built-in review, which I think is still in the pipeline, but it may be that there's a case to bring that forward a bit on the basis of some empirical evidence of experience with BEE. So I take that point on board indeed. The minister is here, and I'm sure he will comment on this thing of a review of, apparently you were quoted as saying that we're going to abandon industrial policy or review industrial policy. I think it's because I work with the minister, and I know what he actually meant to say. I believe he was incorrectly quoted. In fact, on the contrary, he's been saying that we will intensify our efforts in this area for the very reasons that we've been talking about, and that we launched on the basis of a set of actions. Some of them we've been successful, some of them still work in progress, but that, given the environment in which we operate, and the threats of deindustrialization, this is the one area where we have to intensify our efforts. But I hear he's here to comment on that. SACU clearly challenges, because I think that with the outcome of the EPAS in relation to SACU, the integrity of the customs union has been compromised. And if indeed this outcome is implemented, we will have to respond. And I think it's something which is going to require leadership, the cabinet leadership, to determine what is the best way, what is the best response. I personally hope that sense can prevail, because clearly this goes against any sensibility, the direction in which our partners have proceeded. And that sense will prevail. It may be we want to escalate this to heads of state, because at some point in our interactions here, we've had to actually escalate matters to heads of state when we had reached particular deadlocks and so on. and that the matter can be resolved with dialogue, both amongst ourselves, but also with the Europeans, because if the EPAs were concluded on the basis of also strengthening regional cooperation and integration, then in our case it has achieved the opposite effect. And this must be something that our European partners must be prepared to engage with, as it were. But again, I'm sure the Minister would like to comment on that. Part of the challenge in BEE, the issue of alignment of various pieces of legislation, and in particular the Triple P FFA, this is a major problem. And I think even where we can make progress with the current model of BEE, this area, I think you're quite spot on. You've touched on an area that is a major outstanding work to be done. Now, we had gone very far with the Treasury, because the Triple P Act is the Treasury Act. We'd gone fairly far with them in the last period. But they then adopted an approach that incorporated other elements, you know, around DFIs and agencies, and those had not been sufficiently prepared. And so the whole model of how they proposed to deal with this issue, it was actually a review of the PFMA as opposed to a review of this particular act. So they sought to deal with the alignment in the context of a review of the PFMA. But that didn't succeed, and as a result of that, we lost the opportunity to achieve this alignment. I believe that this should be a priority in creating the kind of an environment where BEE can succeed. So I do take note of that comment. It's a very important spot-on comment. I will ask the Deputy DG responsible for incentives to give a feel of this 61% that goes to incentives. How is that structured? And then hopefully, Chair, we'll then give over to the Minister. I think I've tried to cover all of the issues that have been raised so far. Thank you.
Thank you, DG Shadisa Matona. I'm going to appeal to the DDG to really put us through an Olympic pace here. And really, I'm going to give you 2 minutes to tell us about these incentives, because I would like the Minister to make an input and address us. I'd also like to take this opportunity officially to congratulate him within the committee itself of Trade and Industry on his appointment as the Minister of Trade and Industry, and to ask him to join the department he runs just on my left, but yes, there we are. And over to yourself. Is it in fact Mr. Karim? Mr. Xavier, yes, thank you.
Chair, just to respond to the question about the trade policy document that had been promised some time back, I think the Honourable Member is correct. We did begin this process about 18 months ago. It is very close to concluding a document that we would be in a position to present to the Minister for his consideration, and then I think at that point we'd be in a position to share the document more widely. Just to indicate that essentially the trade policy document is a review of our trade performance over the last 15 years, South Africa's trade performance over the last 15 years, a review of changes to the tariff regime over this period, a set of recommendations about the future directions for tariff reform, and then also addressing some of the new issues that have emerged on the international trade agenda, issues like trade in services and others that we need to start to open up a discussion on. And then the final section is an outline of our trade strategy with respect to engagement in the WTO in the region at a bilateral level with a particular focus on South-South. So we intend, it's comprehensive, it's been through about 7 iterations through this consultative process, but I think we're aiming to have it presented to the minister before the end of this month. So that's just an update on that point.
I'll just respond on the question regarding the incentives. The department has got a number of grant programs that it provides for small and medium-sized enterprises. The bulk of these grant programs are in manufacturing, or the bulk of the budget for these grant programs are in manufacturing and tourism sector. And it's mostly for small and medium enterprises that are either establishing new businesses or are expanding. In addition to manufacturing, we also have sector-specific grant programs in the film sector. I've already mentioned tourism, business process outsourcing, and we also have a program for providing critical infrastructure that enables investments to take place. Normally the size of the grant is between up to 30% of the capital that is invested in a project, and in order to access the grant there are normally conditionalities regarding employment creation, being located in a depressed area, being aligned with the DTI sectoral strategies, and so forth. Thanks.
Thank you very much. And once again, thanks to the department directly. And over to you, Minister, and a great welcome. And I really appreciate the committee does and you coming here with us and engaging.
Thanks, Chair. And first of all, I need to apologize for coming here at the last moment. We had a cabinet meeting that was going on, and I had to attend that. Just to say also that because I have come in at the tail end of the meeting, I don't know exactly what you've all been discussing. I've seen the presentations, obviously, but what I thought I perhaps should do then is just give a few high-level indications of what I think are the key challenges and priorities that lie ahead. And I want to start off by just saying that since we know the context is one where the electoral mandate calls on us to actually act more effectively to create quality jobs and also sustainable livelihoods. But we're doing this in very, very difficult circumstances in which there's a serious risk of deindustrialization. And so I don't know exactly, I never saw that report, but all I can say is that I have tried to be open and communicative with the media. But I can't be responsible for what they understand or don't understand of what I say. And I think that you should look at what's put in quotation marks and what's not in quotation marks, and perhaps treat that outside of quotation marks with some caution, because I think on a number of reports recently there's been some misunderstanding. But very far from any idea of removing or not continuing with industrial policy or something like that, the whole intention is to seriously upscale the impact of our industrial policy. That's the whole mission that I think that we're on about. What we have done when we started in the previous administration with industrial policy was we developed a national industrial policy framework, which was a very broad statement of approach and possible instruments that we could deploy in industrial policy. And that national industrial policy framework, I think, continues to be the broad guide. I personally think it could be improved here and there, but I don't think it's worth the effort to try to do so, because I think it's gone through processes of consultation and it provides us with a sufficient basis. What we also did in 2007-08 was we introduced an industrial policy action plan, a first industrial policy action plan. Now that industrial policy action plan set out deliberately to say, let us take some of the low-hanging fruit, as it's sometimes called, or easier to do things in industrial policy, and let's get on and implement those. And that's where it started, both in the area of cross-cutting measures and in the area of sector-specific issues. So a number of lead sectors were identified. They included capital goods and transport equipment, automotives, forestry projects in two provinces, and also chemicals. And there were a number of projects identified within that. And that went along also with work on clothing and textiles, which was seen as a vulnerable sector even at that stage, together with the existing priorities in our GISA program, which were things like business process outsourcing, biofuels and so on. Now, what we did was we implemented some things, and I think there were some important achievements, and one of those was the Automotive Industries Development Program, ATDP, that program which replaced the MIDP. I think that that work was important. We began some work to interact with the public enterprises and state-owned enterprises on the matter of industrialization of the infrastructure program. We started some projects in chemicals. We began to design some new programs for clothing and textiles and so on. But I think, and then on cross-cutting, we did things like introduce a new amendment to the Competition Act, and I think things of that sort. But the point is that when we now move into the next IPAC, we need to make sure that we don't get ourselves in a situation where we choose the easier to do things and don't do some things that we need to do. That's the point. So we're actually aiming to produce a 3-year rolling industrial policy action plan, which we are targeting for the introduction of next year and discussion of the cabinet reportla. And we're looking for that to be a much higher impact industrial policy program. In the meantime, that doesn't mean we're not doing a lot of things in industrial policy. We are. And in fact, our program of action of the cluster identifies a number of these, and I'm just going to run quite quickly through some of them. I mean, first of all, what we're trying to do is address the human resource, organizational, and other constraints to upscaling our industrial policy. There are a number of appointments that we need to be making. We need to develop cadership in industrial policy. And actually, if you just hold on and listen to the cabinet announcement, which I don't think I can prejudge, you'll see we made one even today, important appointment to in industrial policy. And there's a number of other positions which we're trying to fill. We also are looking to enter into a mentorship and traineeship agreements with some of the higher education institutions so that we actually produce a bigger cadre of industrial policy. We also are trying to introduce organizational efficiencies into the department. I don't see a need myself for there to be any big changes in our organogram, but I think the motto of continuous improvement is one which we need to be addressing, and so we're going through quite considerable discussion about systems improvements and things of that sort. And then one of the other things, an important cross-cutting piece of work that we're going to be working on together with economic development is on capitalization of institutions that are able to provide a support for industrial policy. We've got to respond to a crisis situation, and our response is guided by, first of all, can we defend significant numbers of jobs? And secondly, can we defend existing strategic industrial capacity? And then we are trying to turn our short-term response also into laying the basis for longer-term sustainable development in some of these industries. And then we've got some programs which we are working in each of the sectors. In autos, for example, we are going to complete the work of the APDP by coming up with a program for catalytic converters, and then also for heavy and commercial vehicles, including buses. We think this is something that's happening. There's an investment in improving the transport infrastructure linked to 2010, but not only 2010, the bus rapid transit system and so on. And we need to make sure that the buses that are being used on that, the first round, haven't been great in this regard, but we want to make sure that the buses are going to actually be manufactured in South Africa. So broadening the APDP in that direction is important. Metal fabrication, capital equipment and transport equipment. This is a critical sector. I think that this is the one real growth opportunity of an industrial sector we can see in South Africa. These are industries that produce inputs for the infrastructure investment program. The 787 billion we will be spending over the MTF is only part of longer-term infrastructure investment programs which are taking place, energy, transport, ICT infrastructure, and so on. And what we need to do is we need to be working much more energetically with our colleagues in state-owned enterprises to make sure that we achieve the import leakage reduction targets we've been talking about, reducing the import leakage from about 40 to 30%. On clothing and textiles, we have developed a new incentive, a completely new incentive for productivity improvements in the clothing industry. We need to be discussing that with the bargaining council. We are already trying to schedule a meeting and introduce a new program. Pharmaceuticals, we want to leverage tenders in pharmaceuticals, and in particular to see if we can encourage the production of active pharmaceutical ingredients for major medicines. The other sectors, we also have programs which we're going to be pushing forward. This is all in the next 6 months. And then we're going to come up with a larger, a higher impact industrial policy action plan. So I first of all just wanted to completely disabuse any notion that industrial policy is not a priority. It's a massive, massive priority. In enterprise development, I think again the overall strategies are in place. Ours is now to significantly improve on the delivery of enterprise support programs. CEDA has been through a process of internal instability for some time, but we've now got in place a CEO, a new CEO has been in place for a few months, and I believe that she's capable of leading this organization to start increasingly delivering the services that we expect of CEDA. You heard a presentation on the Cooler Direct model that we're talking about. Cooperatives is an area where Ma and Thule and myself have been engaging quite significantly. We're hoping that we can actually very significantly raise our game on cooperatives. I don't believe that we've been doing sufficient on that. On the trade policy front, I think you probably have heard generally the key new directions. We have been engaged in a number of trade negotiations where there's difficulties of one sort or another, and we've had to react to other players' offensive demands. That's been the main content of our engagement in the WTO. How are we going to deal with the demands that have been put on us in industrial tariffs, in the EPA process? How are we going to deal with the trade-related demands which have been put on us? And I think one of the things that we're saying now is we want to start shaping a new engagement in trade negotiations so that we're not just responding defensively, but actually we're able to chart out a new course of trade negotiations which can be potentially much more beneficial to South Africa. And one of the things, if you look at the state of the world economy now, those parts of the world that are growing, those parts of the world that are claiming an increasing share of world trade are the big developing economies. The Chinas, Indias, Brazils, Russia, Indonesia, those kinds of countries are claiming an increasing share of world trade. In addition to that reality, the fact of the matter is that we do not, in terms of South-South relations, yet have a built-in agenda of all these trade-related matters which are bedeviling our engagements with some of the other bigger economies. We have a real possibility of shaping out a new pattern, I believe, of trade-related cooperation arrangements with some of those countries. And so what we want to do is we want to set an agenda over the next few years in which we give a greater priority to something we've all been talking about for years, of actually diversifying our trade patterns away from the traditional patterns towards greater engagement on South-South. I heard a few comments as I was sitting here on the SACU question, and since it's been around, let me just add a few points on that. What we've been saying all along is that we are very concerned that some of the clauses in the interim EPA, as signed now by a number of countries, these clauses as signed in the interim economic partnership agreement, if implemented, could actually create some incoherence within SACU.
They could create a situation in which some countries are obliged to take on obligations that other countries would not want to take on, and in the context of a customs union, that could actually become a matter of incoherence. We've been saying that we've raised these concerns from the start, and the difficulty we had with the signing was that we had a process of engagement with the new European Commissioner for Trade, Baroness Ashton, which led to a negotiating session in March this year, where we actually reached agreement with the European Union about a number of them that needed to be changed. Now, the problem was is that when the demand for signature came up, the European Union said they couldn't put in the clauses we had agreed should substitute the clauses in the interim EPA, because they weren't going to change the interim EPA, and there would then be a declaration that would be attached which would provide a linkage between the interim EPA and what happened in Swakopmund. The difficulty we had was that the phrasing of that link was weak. It said, we will instruct our negotiators to seriously consider the Swakopmund text in a final EPA. And we said, this is simply a statement of best endeavor, standing against a legally binding text which somebody, maybe not the current leadership of the European Commission, but a successor, given that there's quite a bit of instability in European politics, who knows who that is, may choose to implement those clauses in the interim EPA. There was also an outstanding issue which was never resolved, and that was the question of rules of origin. The fact is that the rules of origin under the Economic Partnership Agreement are different to the rules of origin under the Trade Development and Cooperation Agreement. In the first place, they provide better access into the European market. We don't mind about that. Our fellow SACA members and anybody else is welcome to have better access into the EU market if they can get it. The problem was that in return, there was a different requirement, particularly for clothing and textile products. Single-stage manufacture is allowed for under the EPA. Two stages of manufacture are required under the Trade Development and Cooperation Agreement. What single stage means is it means you can take a shirt which has come from somewhere else, add a couple of buttons to it and bring it in. And we simply were saying that those who have signed that agreement are going to have to fix this thing up, because we are not going to allow those kind of products to enter South Africa. That's what we said. That was the point. So we're not actually saying we want to go into SACA and mess it up. We're saying we want to make sure that there's not a situation in which the obligations that have now been signed at the insistence and demand of the European Union do not have some kind of disillusion effect within SACA. And actually, again, I think it was, you know, all sorts of things were said in headlines and in the press, but I'm pleased to say that I actually think that little spat has had a good effect. Because instead of a routine meeting in the next SACA Council, we've agreed to have a strategic session. A strategic session where we discuss what is the future of this institution. We had a strategic session last year in Kasani in Botswana. And essentially our message was this, that SACA can't stand still where it is. It either starts to move forward and deepen integration, and it starts to move beyond the customs union, it starts to take on some elements of an economic community. That would involve us reaching some common understanding about the direction of industrial policy, start to reach some common understanding about the direction of trade policy and the content of trade agreements that we want. And we were saying that if we start to move in that direction, we can deepen integration and SACA can become a nucleus of a closer integration project in the SADC region as a whole and in the African continent as a whole. However, if we don't have a common vision on all of those things, then what's going to happen is inevitably there are going to be processes in trade that are going to see a rollback of SACA closer to a free trade area than a customs union. That's what we basically say. We would prefer the first, but if the second materializes because of the nature of external agreements and external pressures, then we'll have to face the consequences of that. So that's what we've been saying on that agreement. But as I said, I think what we really want to do is to focus on is not getting ourselves caught up in spending all our time and effort on defensive kinds of trade negotiations, when actually there are some much brighter prospects if we set an agenda for ourselves. And then finally, just to say on BEE very, very quickly, I think I heard more or less a couple of remarks on that. There are a number of debates about BEE, a number of debates. They include things about alignment of procurement act to BEE. They include questions about how do we align BEE policies and policies to promote local production. They include things about the broadness of BEE and so on. And actually in the BEE Act, there is an institution which remains to be set up, and that is the BEE Advisory Council. It's appointed by the President, but we've done some work in the DTI, and we've communicated to the Presidency. And I think that my own view is that it would be better for us to be leading those debates through that council. And hopefully we can set that council up in a reasonable period of time, and we can move forward with some of those debates. So let me say, that's the general, those are some of the big policy highlights. As I've been saying, I've been spending quite a lot of my time on little, you know, routine things like filling positions, trying to improve systems and stuff like that. And I think this is what it's about. I mean, we are some distance yet from where we need to be as a department that's really going to be able to up its game and seriously deliver a higher impact industrial policy. The country needs that. We need a response to the crisis, which is going to have a strong linkage between what we do defensively in the crisis and how we're going to move forward and put our economy on a new growth path that is higher labour absorption and quality jobs at that. And quite a lot of this is about basic things like appointments, like faster procedures, like shorter times, less people who have to sign on to dispatches and submissions and things of that sort. So we're trying to address some of these things. And my motto in all of this is continuous improvement. So we started with some of this work. And quite a lot of things of our attention will also be deployed there, because this department, a very big department, very diverse range of functions, but it's got a very, very vital role to play if we are actually going to succeed in delivering what the country expects of us. Thank you very much, Chair.
Thank you very much, Minister. Now, members, it is just going on to 1:30. I do want you to get your lunch. And so I know that there are going to be many, many opportunities for us to re-engage the minister, but I obviously don't want to stifle any urgent question or clarification. So if I may see any hands from what I would call the urgent, pertinent questions, please raise your hands. Sorry, is that the DG wanting to question the minister? But
Chair, there was a question which I didn't deal with of Honourable Njikelan. So I'll be guided by you.
Go ahead.
He was raising a question about coordination challenges and so on, and I think it is an important area, part of the changes, the reason for the changes that have been made in government, new structures created and so on. It's been to help us to deal with this Now, the DTI and the new Department of Economic Development will be the new coordinators of the economic cluster. I would hope that there's an opportunity further down the line for us to engage with the cluster program of action and the issues that we'll be dealing with in that context. But it'll remain an important area of focus if we are going to achieve some of the things that we would like to achieve. And many of the opportunities for industrial development, as the Minister alluded to, lie precisely in those areas where we have to work with our government departments. And so this is another area for continuous improvement. I thought I should deal with that important question. Thanks.
I think that's why that hand was coming up, was it not, Honourable Njakulana? Was it your hand that you were raising?
Yes, Chair. Can I proceed?
Certainly, do go ahead.
Also, I would assume some of the other areas, the TTI is owing us, we'll take it that there will be follow-up down the line, even if it's a new term, but obviously. The Minister, through your chair, one of the other areas one would like just to take up is our focus on coding. The link to the coordinating aspect. Of course, the other assumption, I speak very guardedly, is that some of the COTI members may shift from TTI to the new department, but still, the issue of intra and inter-coordination is still fairly fundamental. It has been raised before, I think still will be raised again. The extent to which COTI members work together and at the end of the day are able to bring about, you know, greater impact. I'm sure my colleagues would be keen to follow and monitor that. Obviously, it's like an engine given a new oil or a new shell fuel, which boosts it, if I can use that colloquial language. But also, one of the things that I would strongly appeal that we pursue is exploring interaction with municipalities on local economic development. Local economy, at the end of the day, is an integral part of the overall economy of the country. There can't be artificial barriers between the economic drive that's done at national level with the local economic development on the ground. Another area is the Minister refers to that the policy framework is fairly stable and there may not be any need to trigger it. But at the same time, he says we need to shift or emphasize on the need to be done rather than the easy to do. And I'm sure we will, in the next few months, work very strongly on that. Because it's one of the issues that earlier when the NIPF was presented to us, we were quite uneasy about. That there are areas that we feel strong that they need to be done, you know, fed strongly. A good example, I remember, I raised the issue of ICT, that to the extent is ICT prioritized, because amongst other things is its impact on ensuring that the cost of doing business is easier. Just one example. On the industrial policy, Kaplan in 2007 claimed that the industrial policy was never consolidated under one of arm of the state. It still remained scattered and at times hidden. I don't claim that this is a correct fact, but then it triggers the question that how is TTI going to coordinate the industrial policy such that this allegation is addressed? Thank you.
Certainly the Minister may, if he wish, just respond.
Thanks, Chair. Well, first of all, I think you're right in anticipating that some of the things you have said will are subject to the ongoing discussions about the division of labour between ourselves and the new Ministry of Economic Development. So, you know, and that will include some responsibility for some of the COTI institutions. And just to say on that, that, you know, some people have said there's going to be a turf war over this, and I think very far from that being the reality. I think that we're working very closely together, because I actually agree that one of the biggest problems in terms of delivering our services is one of coordination. I've been saying, for us to raise our game on industrial policy, we have to address three C's and an R. The one is CADA development, which I talked about. The one is coordination. Another one is ongoing consultation or dialogue, and the R is resourcing. And I think those are the things we have to address. And the coordination across government departments is quite critical, because what we have tended to have in the past is that when you have a cluster which consists of a bunch of people who are all peers, is that when there are different views about something, you end up with a fuzzy compromise. And sometimes what you need is you need a clear decision. Either we're going to do this or we're not going to do this. And the tendency has not been to reach those solutions. So I think the first thing to say is that industrial policy is actually not the responsibility of the DTI alone. It is a policy across government. Our view of industrial policy is not that it's confined to manufacturing. It includes primary sectors, it includes manufacturing, it also includes service sectors. And some of those are under the purview of other departments, even if we're not talking about things which very often are the case, I think, as the DG was talking about. If we want to move on a pharmaceutical industry, for example, we have to engage with health and health medicines control councils and things of that sort. So apart from that, the fact of the matter is that, for example, in agro-industries, which I think you can anticipate will be one of the important focus sectors in the new IPAP, that agro-industries, in the past there were some attempts at clusters in a different sense in agro-industries, and that was, for example, you had a wheat milling and baking cluster, where you brought together the primary producers of the agricultural product plus the manufacturers. And I think that's the kind of thing we need to rebuild again, is that sort of a thing. So coordination is clearly critical, and I think it's critical in raising our game. And as you rightly say, some of the COTI institutions may fall under economic development. But in the meantime, we've had a meeting with the COTI institutions, and I said I want to have strategic engagements with them, not just kind of general sessions. And it seems that we can divide the COTI institutions into a number of categories, and some of them may actually fall into more than one. I mean, first of all, there's the development finance institutions. That's the IDC, that's COOLA, that's SAMAC, those kind of institutions. They're all together. But there's other development finance institutions outside of the DTI family, the COTI family, but at least we have some. Then there's the small business institutions, but it also includes two of the ones I mentioned earlier on. Then we've got sector-wide regulators, or economy-wide regulators. Economy-wide regulators. That's the Competition Commission. That's the credit regulator, those kinds of regulators. And we've got industry-specific regulators. That's the Gambling Council, that's the Lotteries Board, that kind of thing. And then finally, we've got, more in a category as well, we've got the Standards Quality Assurance Metrology, SQAM, institutions. And we're trying to have deeper strategic engagements with those kind of clusters, in addition to going around to individual agencies. So that's what we want to do there. We also have, there's just a straight thing called agency management, which is, you know, the board of one of them expires and we have to start thinking about appointing a new one, that sort of stuff. And how do they submit their regular reports and that kind of stuff. We want to strengthen that with an appointment of a new chief operating officer in the DTI, a senior appointment we've been talking about for some time. And I think, if I'm not wrong, the advertisements for that will be coming out very, very shortly. And it's come out already. But we're looking to make a senior appointment of someone who can do systems and also do agency management. I think that the question of local economic development, regional development in general, which would also include provincial industrial projects and provincial level activity. That's absolutely a major area, spatial economic development. The DTI has done some work on that. I think really we want to see how that divides up between ourselves and economic development. Clearly we have to do something there, but whether the DTI should be developing a capacity, we haven't got that capacity at the moment, to be able to send people to go and assist municipalities to develop IDPs. We haven't got that. But whether we should be developing or not, I think that will depend on the outcome of discussions and processes, and in particular the way in which the division of labor between ourselves and economic development works out. Thanks.
Thank you very much, Minister. At this point, I certainly would like to thank the Minister, the two Deputy Ministers, the DG of the Department of Trade and Industry, the respective CEOs, Kula, IDC, and of course the staff, both the department directly and the respective agencies, for coming here this morning and sharing your way forward with us, the objectives, and of course the challenges that you have identified. On the other side, the members of the Trade and Industry Portfolio Committee, and also I see there was just the chairperson of the Portfolio Committee of Appropriations, who I once worked with in the JBC, among others. But I certainly want to thank the committee for what can only be described as a marathon engagement and for applying your minds so conscientiously throughout this process. Certainly I think that this is a good start to how we intend operating in this committee. You know, work first, everything else second and third. Now, Minister, as I say, it's quite clear that the department has identified the focus priorities, both that were reflected on in the State of Nation address by President Zuma himself, but also identified the challenges that they are facing within DTI to address these new international challenges facing us, as well as, of course, the very real domestic challenges of employment issues, creating decent opportunities, making finance available, especially to the smaller businesses, the whole issue of BBB, EE, etc. And we'll have many other occasions to engage with you, but really it's a sincere thank you from myself that you've managed during a very difficult day to spend time with us and engage us so effectively. Thank you, Chair, the Minister.
I just want to say one thing in advance. You know, you said, Chair, you said that the motto was work first and everything else afterwards. I want to apologize in advance, because what we've been doing is we've been cutting a lot of fluff. So I regret to have to say that this year, when we have a budget, I think, don't expect there to be a big dinner with the band and all that. We'll be having a rather more modest cocktail party in Parliament here. Thank you very much.
Members of the committee, just before we adjourn, I just want to remind you of the meeting on the 23rd of this month, and during which not only will we address the budget process, but also consider the regulations on the interactive gambling bill, which of course you've had with you for some time, and I know you have spent this long weekend studying. Now, there's a lot of paper coming across to you, and clearly you'll have to apply your minds. Thank you to members of staff for being here on time and engaging. And to everyone, there is a little spot of lunch outside. Thank you.